Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. In the first hour of tonight's big show, we're going to be talking about the win in the House last night. Well, for the people like me who believe in public education, for those of us who do, well, huge win. We're going to talk about the fraud. Oh, the fraud. Yes, it's true. The GOP, the voter fraud. You know, the stuff that they told us never happens, or at least they stipulated the fraud. Well, we're going to talk about the fraud. In the second hour, the war on women as Romney tries deception this time as a tactic. Generally, we call that lying, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, deception, and talk about that, and also his flipping, flopping, and basically just doing the fish thing around every issue, especially the contraception issue. And in the third hour, we're going to be talking about tax handouts guised as, job creation. Keep telling us we're going to create jobs with more handouts to corporations without any way of really knowing that that's going to happen. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Wall Street and also where has all the wealth gone and what have they done with it? I know they haven't invested in education, health care, infrastructure, things we need as a nation. So what have they done with it? Where has it gone? Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give us a call or email rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the big news today, well, you know, just like union organizing drives, employers are telling their workers what to do in the confines of the voting booth. So much for the secret ballot. I guess next the employers will be handing out the ballots and collecting them at the end. And where are they getting their marching orders? Interesting bit of audio released here in the last day or so. Evidently, Mittens was talking with the very conservative National Federation of Independent Businesses, the NFIB, one of the Gang of Six, one of the people who I believe have really destroyed this nation. But you know, let's not get all that into that. I guess I should just play the clip of Mittens out there telling folks what to do.
I hope you make it very clear to your employees what you believe is in the best interest of your enterprise and therefore their job and their future in the upcoming elections.
Yeah, you know, hope you make it clear, very clear to your employees what you believe in the best interest of your enterprise and therefore their jobs and their futures. Let me interpret that for you. Because I think some have a problem with reading between the lines. Here's what he actually meant. He said, he actually meant, I hope you'll harass, intimidate, threaten, coerce, bully, mandate, do a little arm twisting, hold hostage, or whatever else you need to do to make sure that I win. I mean, that's the interpretation. And for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about these CEOs. You think of the billionaire timeshare baron, this David Siegel, who threatened to fire his employees if Obama was reelected. I don't know how else to put it. Saying the economy doesn't currently pose a threat to your job. What does is that black guy in the White House. And then a couple of days later, you saw Arthur Allen of ASG Software Solutions, who sent out an email to all of his employees threatening that, you know what, we could lose our independence. We will, I'm already heavily involved in considering options to make our independence go away. So if you vote for that guy, I'm going to sell off the company. We're going to fire everybody. Am I missing something? And then you're going on to say, well, if we fail to make the wrong decision, we lose our independence as a company. That's all your fault. And you look at the Koch brothers who, you know, they're 45,000 employees. They did kind of the same thing. You know, and you go, at what point do we look at these not veiled threats? I mean, these are actual threats. This is right in your face. And you might remember, Murray Energy, one of the coal mines in West Virginia held a big Romney rally. It's where that Josh Mandel said, they think coal is a four-letter word. Yeah, it is, Josh. and he wants to be a senator from Ohio. But they held this big rally and mandated. They said it is mandatory that everyone comes. So you see up there in their nice white shirts, they're standing in front of these dirty-faced coal miners because you need a good prop behind you. And they do their little song and dance, you know, Obama's destroying coal and Obama's going after you and it's all Obama and I hate Obama. It's the black guy in the White House, blah, 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 blah. So you see the story come break a couple days later. For the next couple of days, it's rolling out that these workers were forced to be there, or so they said. There's some out there now saying, well, you know, we weren't really forced. We're signing the letter saying we weren't. The CFO of the company said it was mandatory. It's mandatory. Can't get out of it. It's I don't know what mandatory means in other people's dictionaries, but to me, mandatory means you better get your butt there. So they're docked the pay. They didn't get paid for being there. They didn't get to work. They didn't get paid. And it was mandatory. This is the CFO. This is out of his mouth. He said, you know, well, it was mandatory, but we didn't force anyone. No, we didn't force anyone. I don't know what mandatory means in West Virginia speak. So now they say that, well, there's this letter going out and the workers have signed this letter. And, you know, I start to think of all of these threats, all of this veil, it's not even veiled. I mean, all of these threats, all of these intimidation tactics, where employers are saying, you do what I say, or we're going to crash this economy. You do what we want, or we're taking it all away and you will starve. Your kids will go hungry. You will lose your house, and we'll just go somewhere else. And I look at this and I go, you know, how much power, how much control, how much of this have we ceded to these handfuls of people? You got Joe Walsh running around, the deadbeat from Illinois, saying the same thing. Well, you know, if you run, manage, or own a company, tell your employees, Joe Walsh said. What was the CEO this week that said, if Obama's reelected, I may have to let you all go next year? He said, if Obama's reelected, the Democrats take control. I may not be able to cover your health insurance next year, he told the cheering crowd. He goes on to say, you know what? If there was ever a year for you people who run and manage businesses to energize your employees, you're now, this year. And you go, gee, that sounds awful familiar to what Romney said. And it sounds awful familiar to what we heard all of these different CEOs write in their emails and all the things that they say. Because they're all coming from the same source. And it's not even Romney and his campaign, because Romney's a puppet of the billionaire class. Because he's not really one of them. He's a really rich guy. But he's not in their club. Not yet. He will be. Trust me. If we sacrifice a little bit more, if we give a little bit more, I'm sure he'll be fine. A couple more years of paying less taxes than the guy who sweeps the streets or collects his garbage, he should be fine. But I look at this, and to me, this is that wake-up moment. Because I've been saying this is all coordinated, this is all part of the Gang of Six, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and the NFIB and the Restaurant Association and the Roundtable and all those groups, those right-wing pro-business free enterprise groups who aren't against taking a handout when their tax schemes come up. But there they are out there, like I said, not even veiled attempts at threats anymore. They now feel completely emboldened. And I keep hearing Romney talk about jobs, and I keep hearing the right talk about the economy and how, well, it just hasn't come back under Obama. And you go, well, hold on. You've got this CEO class who right now is sitting on piles and piles, mountains of cash. You have this patriarchal 1% who said, you know what? We're not going to create jobs if you don't give us more. We want that estate tax repealed. We don't want to have to pay that. We don't want to have to pay taxes. We want capital gains cut. We want a territorial tax so we can ship jobs overseas and we can bring that money back. We want to repatriate all that money we've been hoarding overseas. About $1.5 trillion every single year. And I ask you, you know, it's common sense to me. if this billionaire class, if the Siegels and the Allens and the Kochs, if all of these very, very wealthy people are pointing you in a certain direction, shouldn't you ask why? Because it's not about more money for them. They've already got more money than they know what to do with. It's about pure, unadulterated, absolute, complete power. It's about control. And what is interesting to me, and for me, if I got one of these letters, I would definitely be voting the other way. And I'm hoping there is blowback. I'm hoping that, you know, people just say, you know, who are they to tell me? Who are they to threaten? Who are they to intimidate? Who are they to harass? Who are they to put my family in jeopardy? And this is where I think as a working class in this country, we need to come together and push for things to better the working class. I don't care where you are in the working class. If you're punching a clock, you're in the working class. If you're working for a paycheck that comes at the end of the week and it's gone by Saturday, you're solidly part of the working class. And, you know, an interesting statement someone told me one time. You know, Shaquille O'Neal's a rich guy. He's rich. The guy who signs his check, he's wealthy. So to me, Shaquille O'Neal and all of those athletes who make a lot of money, who make for a very short period of time, those are working stiffs too. They're out there punching the clock just like you and me. And we need to, all of us, stand together. And this kind of divisiveness, this kind of sliced and diced and pitting us against one another, we've got to stop it. We've got to stop allowing them to put wedges between us. I mean, you know, when I saw the SB5 fight in Ohio where they had actually divided up neighborhoods, street neighbors weren't talking to each other because they had so badly pitted working people against one another. We're all in this together. When they destroy unemployment compensation, we need to say, no, you need to keep that. That's our safety net for if I ever lose my job. Next year, when they go after workmen's compensation, and they will, we need to say, no, that's the safety net to make sure that I'm not destitute if I get injured. When they continue to go after Social Security, when they continue to go after Medicare, we need to say, no, this is what keeps us secure and safe and out of poverty in our golden years. Maybe we should be asking the people who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. The Koch brothers have pledged $60 million to beat Obama. They have spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 million in this election cycle. You got Sheldon Adelson, a billionaire, spending $100 million. And I say, you know, instead of allowing them to devise with that money, why don't we take it and put it towards education, put it towards healthcare, put it towards actually improving the lives of the citizens in this country? I mean, doesn't that make some sense? Instead of making sure that the Kochs have more than their great-great-great-great-grandchildren 10 generations from now are ever going to be able to spend, why don't we make sure that no kid goes hungry today? Why don't we make sure that workers have the right to collectively bargain? Maybe get some of that. Because that's how we fix this economy. Not by giving more to them and hope that they'll create a job magically, but by giving more to the people who create the wealth so that they'll spend a little bit more and create that thing called demand. Seems rational. Seems reasonable. And instead of allowing them to destroy education, as we've seen all across this country with these ignoramus charter school bills, fortunately, the one that was shot down, which we'll talk about in the next segment, it's coming back, though. Rest assured. Because the moneyed interests, they want it. And sadly, when the moneyed interests want something, they figure out how to buy it. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The day after the presidential debate, six former Sensata workers and their supporters were arrested as they occupied the lobby of the Bain Capital-owned company. Mitt Romney's Bain Capital is sending their jobs to China. The workers are calling on Romney to stop the outsourcing of their jobs by the company that made Romney wealthy. They have set up a tent city called Bainport in Freeport, Illinois, to protest the loss of their jobs to China, thanks to Romney's Bain Capital. The workers tried to deliver a petition to the plant manager. Tom Gallrap is one of the Sensata workers who will lose his job when Bain Capital ships his job to China the day after the election. Speaking in a video the workers produced, Gallrap urged voters not to vote for a Romney economy.
How anybody can go and vote for Mitt Romney is beyond me, because we have seen what this Romney economy looks like here.
Romney's binders full of women remark once again reveals a Romney disconnect and a problem with the truth. Jesse Russell reports.
Of everything Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney said on Tuesday, it was binders full of women that seems to be having the greatest impact, and not necessarily in a good way. Lilly Ledbetter, who gave her name to the equal pay legislation signed into law by President Barack Obama in 2009, said needing a binder full of women to find suitable women for administrative positions showed a disconnect.
That binder didn't help me at Goodyear, and it's not helping the women across this country, making 77 cents for every dollar a man gets. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but over the course of a woman's lifetime, for the same work as men, women make on average $431,000 less than men. $400,000 could buy a house, put two kids through college, and pay for seven more years of groceries.
The other problem Romney is facing is that he didn't actually request the binders full of women. The resumes of suggested women were offered to him by a group called Mass Gap, which had planned to provide the materials to whichever candidate won the gubernatorial election. Jesse Mermel is the former executive director of Mass Gap.
Mass Gap approached the campaigns of candidates Shannon O'Brien and Mitt Romney and asked them both to commit to three things. One, to make best efforts to ensure that the number of women in appointed state positions is proportionate to the population of women in Massachusetts. Two, to select a transition team whose composition is proportionate to the women in the Commonwealth. And three, to meet with Mass Gap representatives regularly during the appointments process. Both campaigns made a commitment to this process.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Well, you know, at least, you know, there was a short-term victory there. There's still lots of work to be done on the voter suppression that Mr. Terzai was talking about. That was going to, and you know what the intent was, solely to steal this election. But you look at what's going on in Nevada, and one of these guys out doing voter registration for the Republican Party evidently told KOLO Radio that He only could register Republicans and folks who were nonpartisan because, well, he didn't get credit for Democrats. You know, he's out there being paid for voter registration, but Democrats, he doesn't get paid for. Why is that not a crime? You know, if you really wanted to make sure that the vote was okay, why not stuff like that? Just a thought. I've got our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, on the line. I'm going to ask him, why is that not illegal?
Well, it depends on who's paying him. You know, if it's purely private, I guess that a targeted voter registration effort is not exactly illegal, but it's certainly immoral. Anybody who engages in conduct that minimizes, marginalizes, or perverts this most sacred of rights, the right to vote in our society, deserves to be punished. Not in this instance in Nevada, but we have found another instance, at least one, I think more than one, in Florida, where there was actually an expenditure of public funds.
Wow.
With the same intent, and that, of course, would be a violation of the civil rights law, Rick, in addition to a violation of several Florida statutes. Here in Pennsylvania, our statutory framework says, among other things, that anyone who engages in any conduct that is intended to or actually achieves impeding a citizen's right to vote is liable for criminal prosecution, and it's a very powerful tool, one that candidly I have contemplated using against members of the General Assembly who adopted or purported to adopt the voter suppression law in Pennsylvania. I, of course, am not a prosecutor. I'm a private lawyer, but there are chapters yet to be writ on this. Let me leave it at that.
Yeah, you know, and I look at this, and you know, back in 2004, there were reports of certain Republican operatives who were going out doing these voter registration drives, and anyone who did check off the Democratic box, they would shred those registrations. To me, that's got to be a crime, right?
Well, I think that is very much a crime, because that, in Pennsylvania at least, is indeed an active and intentional action to impede the right of a citizen to vote, assuming that the registrant for whom that shredding took place was otherwise qualified to vote under Pennsylvania law. So, absolutely. Intriguingly enough, in Florida, the governor, Scott, and the overwhelmingly Republican legislature adopted a law that has since been partially overturned by the courts that said anybody who collected a voter registration form and failed to turn it in within 24 hours was subject to criminal prosecution in Florida. That was adopted there to intimidate organizations like the NAACP and the AFL-CIO and the League of Women Voters from engaging in voter registration drives, because the politicians in Florida like the idea of registration exactly as it was, because that was the registration margin that allowed each of them to win election in their respective campaigns. So this is a chapter that is not over yet in any part of the United States. There have been at least 41 of the 50 states and the three territories and the District of Columbia where voter suppression laws have been introduced, and in several instances they've been passed just in the last 2 years alone. I'm sad to tell you that Pennsylvania is one where not only were several introduced, but where one was certainly passed.
Right.
At this juncture, we have, at least in a preliminary sense, had the most odious and onerous sections of that enjoined by the Commonwealth Court. But it was, as your listeners know, not without a fight that took us to the Commonwealth Court, all the way to the Supreme Court, and back to the Commonwealth Court in not one but two effective trials, in which we had to do things like have 93-year-old Vivette Applewhite testify that after she had voted in virtually every single primary and general election since Franklin Roosevelt, she would be denied her right to vote in Pennsylvania this year if this had not been enjoined, because she unfortunately was mugged in a supermarket in Philadelphia a couple of years ago, and the mugger, in grabbing her purse, took her Social Security card, and she, at age 93, at that point at age 90, didn't drive, doesn't drive, didn't have a driver's license, and had no need for a photo ID that was one, among those that were listed in the Pennsylvania law. And she couldn't get one because she didn't have a Social Security card, and she didn't have a Social Security card because it was stolen with her pocketbook. And she couldn't get a Social Security card because she didn't have a photo ID.
So here she's being mugged by the state.
So she's getting mugged exactly a second time, and this time not by a terrible independent private actor who's just a bum and a street urchin, but by the government of her own state and by the legislators who her tax dollars, among others, pays to finance.
Let me ask you last question on the voter ID thing, because, you know, a lot of people that I talk to think this was a huge victory and we won and it's over. This is not over.
Oh, Rick, this is anything but over. First and foremost, we need to understand that virtually all of the voter ID law in Pennsylvania remains untouched. The provision in the law that requires election officials to ask to see a photo ID is still intact. The provision that compels or requires the state to engage in this so-called educational effort, which has resulted in extraordinary confusion of television and radio commercials and billboards and handouts and direct mail, all of which now you will be asked for but will not need a photo ID in order to vote, and previously said you will be asked for and will be required to show a photo ID in order to vote. All of that is still going on. A number of corporate structures that, under the guise of engaging in a public service, things like public utilities, Philadelphia Electric Company, for example, have been sending out mailers to their customers saying that you need a photo ID in Pennsylvania in order to vote, and even doing that after the injunction was issued, and they're not the government, and we're trying to find ways to halt or stop or slow that down, but that's happening, as we understand, even as I speak to you today, tonight, and it goes on. So all of the other things in the voter ID law, with this sole exception of requiring individuals to show an ID, a photo ID, if you will, as a condition of actually casting a ballot, remain intact. It is only that one item that has been enjoined, and that injunction expires after this election cycle, and we will be back in court on December 13th on the broader-based motion to make a preliminary injunction against the entire statute permanent. And we still have this moving target from the state as recently as yesterday, yet another announcement. If you recall, several weeks ago, the state announced that the PennDOT offices that issue photo IDs and photo driver's licenses would be open and open late on the Monday before Election Day so that people would not be inconvenienced when they had to show a photo ID in order to be permitted to vote. Now the state has announced that they're not going to keep those extended hours in the PennDOT offices or open PennDOT offices that would not normally be open that Monday before Election Day. And that's a problem because people are still going to be asked when they show up to vote to show a photo ID. And if they don't have one, they're going to be upset. They're going to be rattled. And we are going to have a team of lawyers available virtually statewide, volunteers, not partisan, not acting for Democrats or for Republicans, but acting for the labor movement and for the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO in our voter protection program to assist people if they have their right to vote impeded in any way. Obviously, we have some concerns about delays associated with asking people for these IDs. We have some concerns about election officials being confused about what the injunction says and doesn't say. And we have concerns about people who are standing in line and realize that they don't have their ID in their pocket, that they may have left it in the glove box of their car, and what impact that's going to have on them. Intimidation at the polling places and at the voting booths are a real and meaningful concern. And while we want a skirmish, this battle is far over.
Yeah. And speaking of another battle, that was one I saw yesterday, and that will continue. They've already said, you know, look for this charter school reform, they're calling it, but more handouts. Yesterday, a big win. I mean, a short-term win, but still a very big win.
Well, it's a huge win, but let me start where you stopped. There was legislation pending in the General Assembly that received the bum's rush. It was put in print on Monday morning with a 46-page amendment to an otherwise salutary bill that was aimed only at addressing, initially, funding for special ed students in Pennsylvania. And they dropped this huge 46-page amendment in it in the Pennsylvania Senate on Monday that recreated and recast charter school operations in Pennsylvania, passed it on Tuesday, forced it onto the House calendar yesterday, and finally, because of an extraordinary coalescing of unity and solidarity among labor organizations, particularly the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers, the AFT Pennsylvania, AFSCME, service employees, and allied groups, the Rural School and Small School Association, the School Boards Association, the Educational Policy Center, and a number of other groups working together, ultimately we stopped that legislation from even being voted on in the House when a united group of the Democratic caucus of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, led by Minority Leader Frank Dermody and Minority Whip Mike Hanna, and led as well by the extraordinary chairman, Democratic chairman of the House Education Committee, Jim Roebuck, who passionately took apart this legislation in the House Democratic Caucus. And they were joined by at least a couple of dozen Republican legislators of all stripes and from all parts of the state, who collectively said no to the poison that was in this legislation. And by God, this was poison. This was the gift to charter operators. And I'm not talking about the groups of moms and dads who want to start a charter, but these vipers who get contracts to run charter schools on behalf of those moms and dads, and who put the money in their own pockets instead of putting it into the education of our children.
Yeah, I mean, originally some of the things that I saw in it, you know, you just go, you know, the party that keeps talking about local control and the party who keeps talking about transparency and accountability, what I saw out of this, no local control, no transparency, no accountability, no equal treatment, no nothing.
Oh, Rick, to the contrary, what they wrote, and they were so embarrassed by it that they were up in the state capitol lying through their teeth about it. What we had was legislation that created a backdoor statewide authorizer in multiple ways and stripped local school districts of any control over whether to grant or renew charters, and put that all in the hands of the Pennsylvania Department of Education through a really cynical methodology. And then they denied that it was doing it, but the bill had language that said the current holder of a single charter could open up multiple buildings, multiple charters under that single charter, and in so doing come directly under the regulation of the Pennsylvania Department of Education, thereby taking that away from the school district that issued the charter. And it also said that multiple charters could consolidate into a single charter across school district lines. And by doing that on their own, of their own volition and of their own choosing, that would strip all of the local school districts that had issued all of the charters in the context of that consolidation of their right to oversee and regulate and grant and renew charters, and put that in the hands of the Pennsylvania Department of Education as well. And that particular piece meant that school districts like Harrisburg and school district like Camp Hill could find that they have had a consolidation across not only school district lines, but county lines and the river, and have Harrisburg kids go into school in Camp Hill, have Camp Hill kids go into school in Harrisburg. And while that may have any number of worthy social results for a whole lot of reasons, it is a backdoor effort to have the state overtake local school district authority and control over charters. And the most cynical piece of that of all is that that then becomes a completely unfunded state mandate on local taxpayers and the local property taxes that they pay to support schools in their school districts. And if that were all this legislation that was proposed would have done, that would have been and should have been more than enough to stop it from ever being considered. But that wasn't all that was done, and in many respects, it's not even the worst thing that it did. It also had a provision in there that had the state paying the charter operators directly for any reimbursements that they would have instead of that coming through the local school districts. The result of that, of course, would be that the local school districts are local elected school boards that are responsible for paying the cost of charters, not have had any opportunity to review or scrutinize the bills as submitted to even verify that the kids for whom they were being charged
Wow.
were in the schools before the state would pay those bills. And on top of all of that, they had other language in there that said that every charter school would be required to have a private independent audit by an independent auditing firm. And while that sounds really great, I will tell you two things. Number one is there are 180 charters presently issued roughly in Pennsylvania. and that means there would have been 180 separate audits paid to 180 separate accounting firms, each of which is beholden to the charter operator that issues the contract without the benefit of public bidding or anything like that. So all of that money, of course, that should have been earmarked to go to educate children would be instead going into the hands of vendors who would be beholden to the people who passed out the contracts. And according to some people, by putting that in the hands of private audits, it would have stripped the Pennsylvania Auditor General of any right to audit those charter schools, even though they're financed 100% with taxpayer money.
Wow. I mean, just listening to that, I mean, I'm glad that the steamroller broke down and this poison is stopped, but they've guaranteed that it's coming back. It's not dead. I mean, we've slayed the dragon this time, but it's going to come back alive next session.
Well, this is the fourth time in this session that we've had to slay this dragon. And as long as our coalition hangs together, as long as solidarity prevails, we're going to keep fighting back. But this is a true danger. We need true reform, and that's where I was going with all of this. The most cynical piece of all of this, in my humble judgment, is to describe the legislation that I've just described to you as reform. It is something, but its relationship to reform is about the same as a dog's relationship to a fire hydrant. We need true reform. We need transparency in the operation of charter schools. We need accountability in the operation of charter schools in this state. We need fundamental and basic governance requirements in charter schools throughout this state. We need a legal framework that prohibits the charter operators from creaming or being inappropriately selective by keeping kids out of charter application processes by way of all manner of sneaky, underhanded, and discriminatory practices. We need uniformity in charter application. We need uniformity in charter admission. We need to make sure that parents of children who are actually enrolled in charter schools have control of those charter school boards and operations and not outsiders. We need ethical controls to assure that people who are on the payroll of one charter are not on the payroll of another charter. We need ethical controls to assure that people who are running charter schools do not also own the real estate in which those charter schools operate, or are not employed by the owners of the real estate, or do not have immediate family members who are employed by the owners of that real estate. We need to make sure that people who run charter schools don't have contracts with members of their immediate families to provide various vending services or professional services to those charter schools. There's a lot that could be done to reform this. We need to make sure, and this is another thing that this bill specifically evaded and intentionally did so, that the amount of money spent on actually educating students in charter schools is what those schools get reimbursed up to the maximum of what schools in school districts get paid anyway,
right,
when they're school district run schools. This legislation, instead of addressing that issue, created a 17-member panel, 14 members of which were either political appointees or charter school advocates or apologists or operators, and only three were required to be from school districts or actual educators. That was kick the can, and they were supposed to study funding for some point in the future and make a report by April that might possibly result in legislation at some point down the road on a date unspecified. And all the while, that would allow the charter operators and the cyber charter operators to keep charging money based on what they could get as opposed to what they spend on educating our children. And the very, very most sad and objectionable piece of that is that every penny of every dollar that I just described comes from the taxpayers of this state, from the property taxes levied on seniors and on homeowners and on parents trying to make their way through, and on property owners who lease their real estate by local school districts, and then it's confiscated from the local school districts by this action of the state, this action of the people who say they so very much want to maintain local control, and put in the hands of their private charter operators who are then turning around and taking some of their profits and passing out political contributions to the politicians that support their interests. And it is an outrage, and I am so proud and so pleased to have been part of the team that beat this down and kept it ever from even being voted in the House of Representatives yesterday, even after it passed by a vote of 33-16 in the Senate only the day before.
I appreciate the work that you have done and the whole coalition for this round. It's coming back. We know it's coming back, which is why we need to stay up on this issue and have you back again to talk about it again as this moves on down the road.
I'll be very honored to talk about this again and to keep your listeners monitored on this particular poisonous, venomous assault on our children. So thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it. Good to talk to you always, and have a great week. We'll be back next week.
All righty, Irwin, I appreciate the time. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
We gotta get old tonight. We gotta do it today. No more madness.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. Let us now assess the state of the free press in this land of, well, of press freedom. The assessment? Pathetic. Not because of some government clampdown, but because of increasing press pusillanimity. The latest decline in hard-nosed investigative reporting is something called, quote, approval. It began with PR flacks for public officials and political candidates, demanding that reporters agree, as a price of being granted an interview, to submit any quotes they intend to use from the interview to the interviewee's staff for approval. Thus, when Mr. Big blurts out something shocking, stupid, or actually newsworthy, Mr. Big's staff of bowlerizers can tidy it up, or even erase it. Zzzt, it's gone, as though it was never uttered. It's not surprising that today's media-sensitive political figures, including Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, would demand this extraordinary editorial control over what comes out of their own mouths. But it's utterly despicable that media bosses and reporters have so gutlessly caved in to the demand. It reduces reporters from hard-nosed diggers to brown-nosed beggars, and it makes a mockery of our democracy's need for a free press. Yet many of America's major publications have meekly surrendered their reporters' freedom to this restraint. And now, corporate executives have realized that, hey, we can emasculate the press, too. Wall Street barons, Silicon Valley hotshots, and even the bosses of media conglomerates are demanding and getting, quote, approval for stories about their operations. This is Jim Hightower saying, the media columnist for the New York Times admits that he's also succumbed to these demands. If it's a quote I feel I absolutely need, he recently wrote, I start negotiating. Never mind that it's his independence and journalistic integrity he's bargaining away.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do, they shout in your face.
Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I look at this education thing, and I mean, while for now, the quote-unquote charter reform has seen a speed bump in the road, it's been delayed, I'm telling you, what we're seeing right before our eyes is the beginning of a mass consolidation. This mass consolidation is going to lead to a corporate takeover of education. If you think the insurance companies have a stranglehold on education or on healthcare now, just wait till you see what the profiteers do to education. I'm telling you, this is the wrong path. And, you know, Irwin's right on just about everything he said. But what we have to understand is while we've got a governor who's doing absolutely everything he can do to defund education, he's also doing everything he can do to divide what is being funded, to hasten and speed that destruction of public education, so that only the ones who can afford it get to go to the good quality schools. And everybody else, well, no, not so much. And, you know, as a parent, I mean, I've thought of this a number of times. As a parent, you know, I want my kids to get the best education possible. And I think every parent wants that for their kids, too. And then, you know, they get into the, I don't care about what, if it's a charter school or if it's this kind of school. I just want the best education. But what I'm telling you is the studies that have been done thus far, not glowing reviews of charter schools, all the money we've thrown into it, all the money the millionaire and billionaire class have thrown at it, hasn't resulted in better scores, hasn't resulted in better outcomes. But what it's going to do, it's business investment. It is how you get a return on that investment. And we're going to see, I'm telling you, at some time in my lifetime, I guarantee you're going to have one corporation is going to control a mass amount of education in this country. That's simple. Big news. You remember the commissioner, the county commissioner from Philadelphia County, who claimed that there was voter fraud everywhere. Thousands and thousands of cases of in-person voter fraud. It was rampant. Even though the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania stipulated in their pre-trial stipulation that there has never been an investigation or prosecution. They know of none. There's nothing going on. They can't find it here in the Commonwealth, can't find it anywhere else, of in-person voter fraud, that the photo would stop. Now, you may remember back in July we talked about John Enright, the Republican candidate for supervisor in Arizona, who had to withdraw his name from the race because evidently his former companion, who had passed away some 5 years earlier, has been casting ballots all along. And, you know, who knows how that happens? You know, who knows how the ballot goes to the address that they lived at? It gets put in. You know, who knows? Who knows how these things happen? But we hear the Republicans talking about, oh, we need to secure the sanctity of the ballot. Oh, we need to protect the secret ballot. Yet you've got Mitt Romney and Joe Walsh out there, the deadbeat dad, saying, employers, threaten your employees. And you look at the voter suppression all across the country that's gone on, because we need to have these IDs, because after all, Rick, we got to have an ID to rent a hotel room, right? To get on that airplane, to get a library book. Yeah, but I don't have constitutional rights to those things. But that's a whole other argument. You don't see them out there really pushing for all the other kinds of voter suppression, all the other kinds of voter fraud. You know, like the guy we had talked about at the beginning who said, you know, I can only register nonpartisan or Republicans. I can't register Democrats because I don't get credit for them. They won't pay me. Well, now we see the big breaking news out of Rockingham County, Virginia. The sheriff's office there has released a statement that they have made an arrest. Evidently, on the afternoon of October 15th, law enforcement received a complaint from a citizen who claimed that there were voter registration applications in a dumpster behind a building there, a business there in the city of Harrisonburg, Virginia. So the sheriff went, investigated, and they made an arrest. His name is Colin Small, 31-year-old man from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, right in our area here, down in Virginia, doing a little voter registration, evidently hired by the company Pinpoint. Evidently, he was a voter registration supervisor. This is what the supervisors evidently do, according to this report, what Mr. Small did. They claim that he threw away these voter registration. He has been charged with 4 counts of destruction of voter registration applications. That is a Class 1 misdemeanor. He has been charged with 8 counts of disclosure of voter registration applications, a Class 5 felony, and 1 count of obstruction of justice, a Class 1 misdemeanor as well. They said the charges are based upon lengthy consultations with and assistance from the Rockingham County Commonwealth Attorney General's Office. Now you look at this and you go, well, I just threw away a couple applications, right? Just throw them away. Not a big deal. Very big deal. And you go back and you look at the Republican MO for the last several presidential elections. This has been part of it. Holding down the number of people who are registered. You know, in 2004 out in Nevada, out in Arizona, out in California, you saw people who were doing the exact same thing. Any Democratic registration, they threw out or shredded. Another example. But, you know, here's the thing. The Republicans in this state, they didn't want to go after this. No, they didn't want to make this much harder. No. Because this is what they do. This is voter fraud. And yet, you know, it doesn't really surprise me. So when I hear all of this rhetoric, which is why I believe we should have same-day voter registration. I believe you should, you know, like we did in Iraq, just where's the ink pad? Open up the opportunity for people to exercise their right to the franchise. You know, if we had, and this is where I implore people, you got to get to the polls. You look at the policies of the last 30 years, you look at what's gone on. We've been dictated by, you know, not even the majority of people. And when, you know, Paul Weyrich says, you know, hey, you know, do I want everybody to vote?
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Because they're the minority. The good Republican operative, he has since passed on, the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, that was back in 1980. This is not something new. This is not something that has just popped up. This is what they have been doing for generations, which is why, you know, when you see these suppression tactics, it's the same old thing with just another name. Also, you look at what's going on, and it is a fraud. You look at up in Massachusetts, evidently there is a group, Obama supporters for Brown, Scott Brown, evidently his campaign or somebody associated with his campaign has hired a bunch of African-American homeless men to walk around with a T-shirt that says Obama supporters for Brown. They're paid $8 an hour just to wear the T-shirt. And I'm going, well, you know, hey, I guess it's a job, right? You're helping people out. Why not? But it is kind of fraudulent, don't you think? It is kind of, well, never mind. That's why I think this election cycle is so important. And we're at that crossroads. We are really there. I mean, when you're talking about education, when you're talking about health care, when you're talking about tax codes, and later on in the program we're going to talk about where the tax dollars go. I mean, you look at all of this stuff. And I go back to the beginning of the program. And, of course, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com is where you can get our podcast. But you look at that, the statement, you know, Romney talking to the NFIB saying, hey, you know what? Go after him. Go talk to your employees.
I hope make it very clear to your employees what you believe is in the best interest of your enterprise and therefore their job and their future in the upcoming elections.
Yeah, you know, harass, intimidate. Send out those emails saying, well, you know, you could lose your job. You know, and I go back to that moment, that rally in West Virginia, where they were mandated to be there, but they weren't forced, of course. And this letter that some of the employees have signed, and I got an email during the break who said, you know, have you ever been to one of these small towns? Do you realize that these employers, they're the most powerful entity in the community, and if you don't come along, if you don't look like you're on their team, you don't look like you're following them, they will make your lives miserable. They will fire you, they will make your life, and he's right. These coal barons have such power, and we've given the investor class in this country that kind of power, to where you start going, uh-oh, do they have the kind of power to crash the economy? You bet. Because they're the ones who have been holding it back. I mean, we've been giving huge amounts of tax handouts. Have they created the jobs they told us they were going to? No, of course not. And even this giveaway we did last night, House Bill 2626, they keep telling us, well, we're going to cut taxes. We're going to give employers more money, and they'll create jobs. Like it's some magic equation. But it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. The myth does not happen. But, you know, like any good myth, they keep regurgitating it enough and they keep spouting it enough and pursuing the same failed policies that it's, and look, they'll make up a success story. They'll have a press conference. They'll have a ribbon cutting. Sure, they will. And then we'll forget about it. Because that's what we do. Our media, not very savvy, not very much into the investigative side of journalism. More like stenographers. So when I look at the things that have been going on, man, we got to start thinking about this stuff. And we really need to be pushing back. I cannot believe that this race is that close. Because what got us into the mess we're in is exactly what Romney's peddling. I mean, well, it is exactly what it is. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Of course, if you missed any portion of the first hour, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you can download the podcast or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Quick back. Right back with Hour 2.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The day after the presidential debate, six former Sensata workers and their supporters were arrested as they occupied the lobby of the Bain Capital-owned company. Mitt Romney's Bain Capital is sending their jobs to China. The workers are calling on Romney to stop the outsourcing of their jobs by the company that made Romney wealthy. They have set up a tent city called Bainport in Freeport, Illinois, to protest the loss of their jobs to China, thanks to Romney's Bain Capital. The workers tried to deliver a petition to the plant manager. Tom Gallrap is one of the Sensata workers who will lose his job when Bain Capital ships his job to China the day after the election. Speaking in a video the workers produced, Gallrap urged voters not to vote for a Romney economy.
How anybody can go and vote for Mitt Romney is beyond me. Because we have seen what this Romney economy looks like here.
Romney's binders full of women remark once again reveals a Romney disconnect and a problem with the truth. Jesse Russell reports.
Of everything Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney said on Tuesday, it was binders full of women that seems to be having the greatest impact, and not necessarily in a good way. Lilly Ledbetter, who gave her name to the equal pay legislation signed into law by President Barack Obama in 2009, said needing a binder full of women to find suitable women for administrative positions showed a disconnect.
That binder didn't help me at Goodyear, and it's not helping the women across this country, making 77 cents for every dollar a man gets. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but over the course of a woman's lifetime, for the same work as men, women make on average $431,000 less than men. $400,000 could buy a house, put two kids through college, and pay for 7 more years of groceries.
The other problem Romney is facing is that he didn't actually request the binders full of women. The resumes of suggested women were offered to him by a group called Mass Gap, which had planned to provide the materials to whichever candidate won the gubernatorial election. Jesse Mermel is the former executive director of Mass Gap.
Mass Gap approached the campaigns of candidates Shannon O'Brien and Mitt Romney and asked them both to commit to 3 things. 1, to make best efforts to ensure that the number of women in appointed state positions is proportionate to the population of women in Massachusetts. 2, to select a transition team whose composition is proportionate to the women in the Commonwealth. And 3, to meet with MassGap representatives regularly during the appointments process. Both campaigns made a commitment to this process.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So today, back in 1911, after considerable pressure from parents, teachers, and advocates, the city of New York agreed to pay women teachers the same as they paid men. 1911. I mean, think about this. Put it in context of the question last the other night during the debate, where this Catherine Fenton stood up and said, you know what, I'd kind of like to be paid the same as men. And you see the conservative rag, the Free Beacon, going after and attacking her. Because that's what they do. They're going to tear her down because, heaven forbid, we should treat women the same. Also today in 1983, General Motors agreed to hire more women and minorities as part of their contract agreement with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And, you know, the thing is we're still fighting this every day. And, you know, I guess I wouldn't mind living in conservative world so much because, you know, I'm a man. But I got those two daughters. What's the future going to be like if we continually allow these crazy right-wingers, well, to dictate what happens to our daughters and our wives and our... It's insanity to me. But here to go through some of the debate talk, some of the issues going on right now, I've got Lindsay Horvath, former member of the West Hollywood City Council, also a prominent community activist. Lindsay, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at what Mitt Romney did during the debate. You know, and for me, a huge flip-flop, if you will. He was a guy who signed on to the Blunt Amendment, signed on to the personhood bill, signed on to all of this taking away of contraception, in fact, perpetuated this mythical war on religion, and then in one sentence says, I think every woman should have the right to access to contraceptives. I mean, which Mitt did we see?
You know, women are smart, and he really underestimates our ability to figure out what the truth is, and One statement on one night doesn't mean that he's going to stand by that policy. We've seen that time and again, not just on his positions specifically for women's issues, but on every single issue that we've heard him debate against our president. And I know that women are paying attention, and that's why women consistently are favoring Barack Obama in this election.
You know, Romney just came out with a new ad, and I got to play it for you because, I mean, it's almost an insult. But here's the new Romney ad on abortion.
You know, those ads saying Mitt Romney would ban all abortions and contraception seemed a bit extreme. So I looked into it. Turns out Romney doesn't oppose contraception at all. In fact, he thinks abortion should be an option in cases of rape, incest, or to save a mother's life. This issue is important to me. But I'm more concerned about the debt our children will be left with. I voted for President Obama last time. But we just can't afford 4 more years.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, Mittens. What catches my attention right away is the ad was partially shot, and I can't make this up, in the kitchen.
Well, that's where he said he wanted to make sure his women that came from the binders he supposedly had, these binders full of women, that's where he wants to make sure those women can go when they're done after a hard day's work, as we heard him say in that debate.
Yeah, I mean, is there any justification for that statement? I mean, I guess you could, one could maybe make the argument that, you know, he's trying to identify with women, that maybe he empathizes with how hard they have. Any justification?
Look, you know, I applaud him for recognizing that he didn't have any women in the room, that he didn't have any women on his list, which is astounding given the number of years he spent working at Bain Capital and other major corporations, that he couldn't think of one woman off the top of his head, or a whole slew of women. Just speaks to how few women he had around him in all of his positions of leadership, including in the private sector. But whatever his intentions are, and I'm sure they were good, what we saw is that he's just simply uncomfortable with discussing women in leadership.
Yeah, and you know what gets me, Lindsay, is you look at this whole, what the right is trying to tap down, all of the things that they've stepped in, because I truly believe what's come out of the mouths of Todd Akin, what's come out of the mouths of Rick Santorum and Huckabee and all of these extreme radicals on the right is what they've been whispering to each other for years, that, you know, that women are basically secondhand citizens, you know, the forcible rape comment, you know, it just kind of leaves you scratching your head. But then on the other side, they keep saying, well, there's this war on religion because we want women to have access to health care, because we want them to have choice. Somehow we're going after the church, which to me just seems nonsensical.
Look, I'm Catholic. I know that President Barack Obama is very concerned about religious freedom. And I know that with Obamacare, he made sure that there were exemptions for religious organizations. He made sure to put the onus on the insurance companies to make sure that religious organizations didn't have to violate their moral code. So this contention that there is a violation of religious rights going on is just simply not true. It's a nice talking point, but it's not true. And, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, all voters, especially women, are paying attention, and we're going to vote for someone who speaks the truth.
Well, I mean, the hope is that, but, you know, the polls that I've been seeing actually are showing the trend shifting, you know, the women vote kind of coming back together a little bit, which scares me.
Yeah, it's certainly scary, and I think that's why we've seen, especially from Barack Obama's campaign, you know, some more advertisements and some more education for women about what's really at stake here. You know, I think it makes sense that people would be confused, because Romney says he's for something when it's advantageous for him in one room, and then he says he's against it when he's in another room, if it makes sense for him to win over whoever is in that room. And, you know, just like we heard him make comments about the 47% that he's essentially given up on in this country, we know what he says behind closed doors just to earn people's votes and get their money. And, you know, quite frankly, that's not the kind of president I want leading our country. I want someone who says the same thing to the American people, whether or not there's a camera in the room.
Yeah, but Lindsay, didn't you hear he has changed his position on that as well? He now cares about everybody.
Well, you know, it's nice that he can say that, but I'd like to see that put into action.
And, you know, he loves everybody, and he loves trees because they're the right height, and lakes, and he loves puppies, especially when he's strapped to the hood of his car.
Just like, you know, just like the president said, I don't think that Mitt Romney is a bad man. I just don't think he's in touch with what America needs right now. And I think that anyone who's paying attention knows that Barack Obama, while he hasn't solved all of the problems in 4 years, I don't know anyone who could have solved the magnitude of problems he was dealt when he first took office, let alone in 4 years. So I just think that he knows what America needs. He's been fighting the good fight, and he's been consistently lowering our unemployment rate. He's been making advances in technology, in energy, renewable energy sources, new energy sources. I think that's the kind of leadership we want. And, you know, I think it's also interesting when we talk about, you know, quote-unquote women's issues. We heard the president say in the debate on Tuesday that women's issues are family issues and they're middle class issues. And I think that that's what I want to see in a president.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, but I want to go back to this war on religion that the right keeps throwing up at me. Because, you know, this frame of, you know, we're this grand Christian nation, and I would love to believe that if the actions, if the actions matched the words. You look at the Paul Ryan budget, 62% of the cuts that he pursues are on the most vulnerable people in the country. So he's going to balance his budget off the people who can't afford it. Yet those folks who are doing wildly well, paid a tax rate lower than their brethren of the past, they're not asked for anything. That seems to be okay. And I'm kind of confused at how that squares with the whole Christian nation thing.
Well, you know, I think the vice presidential debate was also very interesting in that regard, because we saw contrasted two very different forms of Catholicism. You know, we saw Paul Ryan talk about his Catholic values in the terms of being anti-abortion, but what we heard from our vice president is that his Catholic values speak to Catholic social teaching, and the foundation of Catholic social teaching is a commitment to the poor and those who are the least among us in society. And if you look at the Democratic platform, we have a plank in our platform all about addressing issues of poverty. You don't see that in the Republican Party. You don't see that on the Romney Ryan ticket. You don't hear it in their discussions. And you haven't even heard them bring up the poor in any of the debates. I just think that when they're not focusing on the people who need help the most, they're certainly not living up to their Christian values.
Yeah, well, I mean, you do hear them talk about the poor quite often. They use them as a punchline. You know, 1 in 6 are in poverty, and, you know, 1 in 4 children are in poverty, and they get food stamps. And every time I hear Ryan or Romney talk about, you know, the poor, it's always, how can we take from them? How can we, you know, make them knit bootstraps and pull themselves up?
Yeah, well, it'd be nice to hear what this supposed Romney plan has in store for the poor, because I think, you know, he keeps talking about this plan that he has that he's only going to tell us about after he's elected. I'm sorry, I want somebody to be transparent with me before they're in office.
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of look at that as like most of his plans. He's got several, and it depends on which one you want to hear that day. I mean, I got a whole bunch of plans.
Exactly. And, you know, I just trust that the president has a good plan for women, that he's looking out for the least among us and living up to Christian values. Christian values that he himself holds. And, you know, I see the Romney Ryan ticket as really putting us in further danger and putting us in harm's way. I also see the Romney Ryan ticket significantly lacking in any substantive foreign policy. And given the issues that are at stake and recent actions that we've seen taken against our own embassy, I trust that, you know, President Obama and has the understanding and the leadership to be able to address these issues.
Yeah, I wonder if by chance Romney were to be elected, you know, what would he do in the White House if Obama wasn't there for him to take the opposite side of?
Yeah, well, you know, I think President Obama has surrounded himself with very knowledgeable people. I trust that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton can handle these issues, because she's proven time and again that she can not only address these issues as our current Secretary of State, but also she is willing to, you know, she's willing to have those make those difficult calls and those difficult decisions, and she's willing to make sure that at the end of the day, Americans are safe, and that's what we need.
Now, I mean, I got to be honest. I look at this election, and to me, there has not been a clearer choice since 1980. And on energy, on women's rights, on, you know, on workers' rights, you know, across the country, you want to talk about workers' rights. I mean, you got Romney who's running around saying, we want the no rights at work agenda. We're going to push right to work across the country, not just state by state, but across the entire nation. Mr. I believe in the 10th Amendment. We're going to screw workers in every state with one federal law. Enough about the 10th Amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Paul Ryan, from the state that's trying to diminish workers' rights and abilities to organize at all, I think that, you know, that once again speaks to the values that they hold for working class people. You know, I just don't trust that they understand the magnitude of issues that our country's facing right now, and I certainly don't believe that they have the ability to address them.
Yeah, last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, I get all these emails from folks constantly just berating the black guy in the White House, and, you know, you try and get a mental picture of, you know, where they're coming from. And quite often, you know, is it just that he's the black guy in the White House? Is it about greed? Is it about being overly misinformed? I'm still trying to get a handle on that. Any insight?
You know, I think that, unfortunately, racism is still a very pervasive issue throughout our country. It's something that can't be ignored, and I'm certain that it has a role to play in this election. But I think, you know, Barack Obama is an excellent president. and we should be focusing on people's qualifications, not their race or nationality. We need to be focused on, you know, who's going to be the best leader to lead this country in the right direction. Yeah. And who has the qualifications to get us back on our feet and lead us continuing in this 21st century economy? Who's going to turn it around for us? And right now, I don't believe that Mitt Romney cares about anyone who's struggling in this economy. I don't think that he has any understanding of what needs to be done. And, you know, his private sector experience has only meant more American jobs going overseas. And that's not the direction I want my country to be going.
Yeah, I often wondered why I've been wondering why Obama didn't hit him over Sensata Technologies. Right now, Bain Capital, the spawn of Romney's loins, if you will, they're packing up a company right now, crating up the machines, laying off the workers, and shipping China as we speak. And you know, you got Romney who's trying to talk tough. He's going to label them. He's going to label China. He could make a huge statement by turning around and saying, Bain, don't move those jobs.
Well, what I don't understand is how he can complain about our unemployment rate when he himself, as a leader in the private sector, was laying people off and contributing to those unemployment numbers. I mean, that's an issue that I'm very concerned about, that when he was given the opportunity to find new ways to keep people's jobs, to innovate his businesses, and to help them grow, to help support American workers, he said, no thanks, I'm going to go overseas, and I'm going to get the tax breaks that benefit me and my buddies in leadership and put American workers on their butt. And that's not the kind of leadership I want in the White House.
I'm right there with you. Lindsay Horvath, I appreciate the time. It's great talking with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Is America truly the land of the free when working families have to struggle to survive? Are workers free to achieve the American dream?
The Teamsters Union is North America's strongest union. We fight for our 1.4 million members and all of America's working families. Teamsters are fighting for the rights of the middle class in Washington, in state capitals, in city councils, and most important, in the workplace. Join us in the fight to keep the American dream alive.
Connect with the Teamsters Union at Teamster.org, Facebook, and Twitter.
But the fact
Vice
is,
President Cheney, though, said it's not a Ponzi scheme. You say it is.
Absolutely. If Vice President Cheney or anyone else says that the program that we have in place today and young people who are paying into that expect that program to be sound and for them to receive benefits when they reach retirement age, that is just a lie. And I don't care what anyone.
Earth. Sky.
Researchers suggest the bright lights of cities visible on Earth, even from space, have the potential to reveal the existence of alien life on other planets.
Someday we might want to look for city lights on distant worlds. That's according to Avi Loeb of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and Edwin Turner of Princeton University. The researchers point out that as our technology has moved from radio and TV broadcasts to cable and fiber optics, we become less detectable to aliens. If the same is true of extraterrestrial civilizations, then artificial lights might be the best way to spot them from afar.
Loeb and Turner calculate that today's best telescopes ought to be able to see lights as bright as those of Earth's biggest city, Tokyo, in the outer part of our own solar system. In other words, if there were any cities on the edge of our solar system, we ought to be able to see them now.
It's doubtful there are cities on, say, Pluto. And all the stars, even the nearest ones, are no closer than 10,000 times Pluto's distance from the sun. So we don't yet have telescopes that could see city lights on planets surrounding these distant stars.
But future generations might spot them. To learn more, come to EarthSky.org and search for alien cities. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Rick has a dream.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So Peter King last night was on CNN, and you look at this whole situation on Libya where during the debate, Romney thought he had him, man. Romney thought, I got Obama on the ropes. I'm going to stick it to him. And Obama said, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, keep digging. Keep going, buddy. Well, Peter King decided to jump in because the two Republican talking points on Libya is one that Obama didn't mention terrorism for 14 days. And the other part is he didn't mention it at all. He didn't say it was an act of terror or anything. So he didn't say it for 14 days and didn't say it at all. So Peter King, well, in one sentence pretty much undoes those both talking points. He said, quote, I'm going to use my words very carefully. He said, I think the president's conduct and his behavior on this issue has been shameful. And for the first time, as far as it's being an act of terror, the president... He was almost 4 minutes into his statement on September 12th before he mentioned the act of terror. 4 minutes! Wow. That's a big difference in 14 days, don't you think? Just a thought. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Bill on line one. How you doing tonight, Bill?
All right, Rick. How about you?
Oh, I can't complain. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm sure you've probably heard of the investigative reporter Greg Palast.
Sure. We've had him on the program a number of times.
Well, I think you should get him on again. He was, I happened to hear him today on some alternative radio, and he was talking about Romney. And according to him, Romney made $115 million in bailout money.
Well, originally the report was $15.3 million, and he's not sure. He said there could be tens of millions of more, depending on, it's a nation story that's out.
Okay, well, Greg apparently has done considerably more research in all this.
No, this is his research from The Nation. He actually wrote the piece.
Okay. Well, this is, as I say, this just came out. I just heard him today. So at any rate, he said Romney, his silent partners with four others in what's referred to as a giant vulture fund.
Yep.
His wife, well, Paul the Vulture Singer, has a silent partnership with Ann Romney. And this is how Romney was able to get away with not really saying, you know, exactly where his money is. He knows damn well where it is.
Absolutely. And you wonder why he calls people like you and me and folks who want to see all of his tax returns small-minded.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you know, I'm not a fan of Obama, but I'll tell you, you know, you have a lot of idealism, and I think like me, you have a lot of anger. I think your audience is the same way. And the more you read, the more you hear, it's taking on an aura of just total unbelievability. I mean, your jaw drops when you hear this stuff.
Yeah, and the thing that gets me is we have a corporate-controlled for-profit media in this country who fails to report it. You've got to get that through alternative means. You've got to get it through podcasts and through things like that, because our mainstream corporate-controlled media, based on advertisement of companies that Bain may own, you're never going to hear from them.
Exactly. I mean, it's right down to literally our local newspapers. I mean, the advertisers own it, let's face it, and that's what's going to be in there, whatever they like.
Yep.
Here's another thought for you. There's a lot of talk about the Middle East. Well, one thing I would really there's actually two things that I'd love you and your audience to consider and possibly delve into more thoroughly. The one being British mercantilism, which in my mind is basically what's running the show here. You know, that and the international bankers. The other thing I'd like to refer you to is a book that came out, I think it was 2003. It's called All the Shah's Men. It's by, I believe his name is Stephen Kinzer. If you want to see what is probably eventually even going to happen here, read this book. You will not believe what was done to those people.
Oh, yeah.
Literally over centuries. I mean, the funny part of it is, you know, the man in the street over there to this day really doesn't hate us, but what we've done to them, the system that virtually enslaved them, yes, they do hate it. And it's no wonder why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you hear we're going to war in this place or that place because of our interests, it's not your interest or mine, it's corporate America's.
Well, that's my great fear with Romney. I do think, and as I say, I've got a lot of issues with Obama, but I do think this whole, the foreign policy adventurism, I think, is very likely to accelerate under Romney. And I'll tell you something else I heard.
Hit me.
I'll tell you something. I'm beginning to believe, really, that the Democrats are throwing this election. I'm really beginning to believe that because they are not hitting this guy where he needs to be hit. They really aren't. And the big rumor that's going out nowadays in right-wing circles and everything is Obama, should he be reelected, is going to enact an executive order which is going to suspend the Second Amendment. I mean, I listen to this, even the local.
Come on.
Well, I know, but I listen to the local. But this is what these people.
One,
believe.
He couldn't. One, you can't do that because it is a constitutional amendment. Good luck on doing that.
I know, but if you listen to the good old boys, I listened for lack of anything else on the radio at that particular time. I often listen to Bob Durkin.
Oh, geez.
I mean, you've got to listen to these people. But that's the general public, Rick. Come on, that's what's out there.
Well, I mean, that came from the NRA. They need to raise. They need fundraising opportunities. You know, there hasn't been the attack that they were hoping for on guns because Democrats have walked away from the issue. There hasn't been a piece of legislation proposed on gun control.
But what I'm saying is, you can't like Obama did in the first debate, just kind of sit back and be bullied. You can't. You've got to start hitting these people word for word with everything they come out with. You know, I mean, they're professional liars. What do you want from them, you know?
Well, Goebbels was right. The big lie, man. And we're seeing it. I mean, we are seeing it right before our very eyes. Because, you got Romney right there telling the lie over and over again. He didn't say anything for 14 days. And finally, Candy Cruelty goes, no, that's not right.
Well, listen, really, what I'd like to know is, and look into the background of Gaddafi. One of the big scandals that's come out, Gaddafi tried to play ball with these guys. I mean, he tried to change his image. He financed Sarkozy's re-election. I mean, these guys stabbed their little minions in the back right and left. And the people that are really in power there now, more and more so, are Al-Qaeda. And the same thing's going on in Syria.
Yeah, well, if you remember, Gaddafi was one of Bush's boys. I mean, he was on board. He gave up his nuclear weapons for a whole boatload of cash.
This is what I'm saying. We were playing nice with him for a while, and then all of a sudden, I don't know what line he crossed. But all of a sudden he had to go. And who's in power now? The fundamentalists, the nut factor. Same thing in Syria. I mean, the churches are attacked in Syria. The synagogues and stuff are attacked in Syria. Nobody says anything. And I'm not saying Bashar al-Assad is any, nice guy or anything. But he's being set up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, none of them are nice guys over there. But, and a lot of them are our guys. That's the sad part of it.
Well, yeah, they are. They're right in the back pocket. You read this, all the shows, man,
I'll tell you,
your head will spin.
I'll take a look at it.
Your head will literally spin what these people, what our people did and what traitors among them did screw that country. And, of course, what was the result? The nuts came into power. You know, the bottom line from this guy who wrote the book was, Iran would have been an advanced democracy going on 50 years now, would have been probably close to becoming a first world nation, and literally, through various machinations, they've been sent back literally in the Stone Age. It's insane.
Yeah, I'll take a look at it. I appreciate it, Bill. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Call back again anytime.
Sure.
Let's take
Bye-bye.
A quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you.
Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Let us now assess the state of the free press in this land of, well, of press freedom. The assessment? Pathetic. Not because of some government clampdown, but because of increasing press pusillanimity. The latest decline in hard-nosed investigative reporting is something called, quote, approval. It began with PR flacks for public officials and political candidates, demanding that reporters agree as a price of being granted an interview to submit any quotes they intend to use from the interview to the interviewee's staff for approval. Thus, when Mr. Big blurts out something shocking, stupid, or actually newsworthy, Mr. Big's staff of bowlerizers can tidy it up, or even erase it. Zzzt, it's gone, as though it was never uttered. It's not surprising that today's media-sensitive political figures, including Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, would demand this extraordinary editorial control over what comes out of their own mouths. But it's utterly despicable that media bosses and reporters have so gutlessly caved in to the demand. It reduces reporters from hard-nosed diggers to brown-nosed beggars, and it makes a mockery of our democracy's need for a free press. Yet many of America's major publications have meekly surrendered their reporters' freedom to this restraint. And now, corporate executives have realized that, hey, we can emasculate the press, too. Wall Street barons, Silicon Valley hotshots, and even the bosses of media conglomerates are demanding and getting, quote, approval for stories about their operations. This is Jim Hightower saying, the media columnist for the New York Times admits that he's also succumbed to these demands. If it's a quote I feel I absolutely need, he recently wrote, I start negotiating. Never mind that it's his independence and journalistic integrity he's bargaining away.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
I think what we did was reform the student loan program. We're not cutting money out of it. In other words, people aren't going to be cut off the program. We're just making sure it works better.
But I guess that's why they say every rose has its thorn. Just like every night has its dawn. Just like every cowboy sings a sad, sad song. Every rose has its thorn.
Yeah, I gotta be honest with you. Anytime I hear a Republican use the word reform, run. Cover your wallet and run. Because it's a screw job is coming. And, you know, he was talking about, a young woman had asked him about funding higher education and Pell Grants. And I said, you know, why'd you cut it? You go, oh, we didn't cut it. We reformed it. So it works better. Better for who? And you look at the Romney plan, which, you know, Ryan was, you know, the Ryan plan that Romney signed on to, going to cut Pell Grants for nearly a million college students. It's amazing to me. And this whole cost shifting that's gone on over the last 30 years. You look at the latest report from the Project on Student Debt that said 66% of the class of 2011 borrowed money to fund their education. Average debt, $26,600. That is not how we prepare the next generation, the people who are going to take care of me when I'm old. That's not how we do that. It's not how we invest in the country, and that's not how we remain a superpower if that's what we still are. But here to talk about the Pell Grants and what we're doing to college students, I've got Ann Johnson. She is the Director of Campus Progress to come talk to us. Ann, thanks for taking time for me.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
So I look at this, $26,600 average debt for the average college student. That is mind-blowing.
It is. It's a remarkable number, and the scope and the size of this debt on young people today who are trying to get an education, get a good job, and be able to, be productive in the economy. The debt load that young people are carrying at, 20, 22, 24 years old is actually having a negative impact on our economic growth.
Yep.
It's not just an issue for young people to deal with, like, right away after college. This debt actually follows them for decades into the future. It's a huge issue.
Until they pay it off or die, because you can't discharge it through bankruptcy, so you pay it off or you die. Those are your two choices.
Right.
And, the thing is, as we've been deindustrializing the last 30 years and shipping our jobs over to China and India and Vietnam and everywhere else, people have been saying, we've been sold, hey, you got to get a college education. The only way to the middle class is go and put yourself deep in hock. And look where we are.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people know that you need to have a college education to be able to get a great job. And, whether it's a traditional four-year college education or a great trade school or community college, having access to higher education is hugely important for young people. Our generation, the millennial generation, is 90 million people strong. And we have to make sure that young people have access to that higher education so they can get the good jobs and the skill training that they need to be able to compete in a global economy. And the Pell Grant program is critically important to be able for young people to be able to afford higher education. So we talked about student debt. There's this huge amount of student debt, and the Pell Grant program is actually so important because it provides young people with actual grants. It's not a loan. So there are about 8.5 million people who rely on Pell Grants every year to be able to go get their higher education. It's a huge amount of money. It's about the maximum Pell Grant award is about $5,500. And young people and students who are returning to college or their trade school to get an education, they have access to that, to those grants to be able to, get the education that they need. Without those, you would see a huge decrease in people who are able to attend higher education. And the thing is that the Pell Grant program is it's specifically targeted to middle class, working class folks. Pell Grants are limited to people who make less than $50,000 a year.
So
this is really the folks that we need to be able to get into college and who have a hard time taking out those massive loans. So Pell Grant programs are critical to them.
And now you've just emphasized why it has to be destroyed. It's only for people who make less than $50,000 a year. And Mitt Romney doesn't know any of those people.
That's right.
I mean, so, hey, if you don't identify with that, you have to destroy it. And you said $5,500 a year. What's the average tuition for college now? What's the going rate, the average going rate?
I mean, there are schools now that are charging $50,000, $60,000 a year to go to get a college education. Now, there's a lot of good choices that people, that have to be able to get their higher education. There's great community colleges. There's state schools. So I think if people look and really try to find the best value for their dollars, I think they can find some affordable options, but the Pell Grant program is critical to help people get there.
Yeah, but $5,500 isn't going to – I don't know any college where you're going to get a year of tuition for $5,500.
That's right. I mean, it's a combination of grants and loans that are getting people through college. Mitt Romney said a couple weeks ago when a student asked him about college affordability and what to do to be able to afford college, Mitt Romney actually suggested that young people should shop around and find a good deal. And then if they can't pay for it, they should just go ask their parents for a loan to be able to cover college costs. Well, obviously that's not an option for most Americans.
Well, I mean, if we could go ask our parents for a loan, if they had the money, then we wouldn't need the damn Pell Grant.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I guess, again, you go back to the world that he lives in. And, I look at this, and $5,500, if I remember right, I mean, some 25 years ago when I was going to college, the Pell Grant was like $4,000 a year. I mean, we haven't seen a large increase in that number, have we?
No, not at all. And the Pell Grants have not kept up with the inflating cost of a college education. In the last 3 decades, college costs have actually gone up by over 1,000%. So the costs of tuition are just skyrocketing. Our programs to be able to help people afford those skyrocketing tuition levels are not keeping up with that increase. So you're seeing Pell, which is an incredibly important part of people's financial aid packages, is not doing what it used to do to be able to help people get to college. And every year we have the same fight where we're advocating for, to save Pell. Last year we went through an enormous Save Pell campaign. This year we spent about 4 months 3 months this spring and summer organizing around the Stafford student loans. We ran a campaign around Don't Double My Rate to keep the Stafford subsidized student loans, which is a federal student loan that's available to lower income folks. We had to fight and fight to keep it at a reduced interest rate. And there are over 7 million people who rely on that loan. And their rate was set to double to 6.8%, which would have cost those 7 million borrowers over $7 billion in interest payments over the life of their loan.
Oh, that's good
and we
point.
Were able to fight hard and keep that down, but every year we're having the same fights.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me, and I keep hearing the Republicans talk about our debt and our deficits and how it's, you know, it's saddling the next generation and how they care. Oh, they care so much. They just care so much about the next generation, especially when they're attacking Obama over the deficits and the debt, We've saddled them with all of $1 trillion in student loans. That doesn't seem to play into their calculus. We care about that, but not the funding of education. And I look here in Pennsylvania where it was told to me back in the 80s, the state picked up 2/3 of the cost of higher education at the state schools. Tuition made up the other third. Today, tuition makes up 3/4 of the cost of going to college. Just to emphasize how much we've walked away from this generation.
Yeah, and we're asking young people to just take out loans and pay for it. We've seen it across the country. I think in Pennsylvania in the last few years, it's about 13.5% decrease for state funding of higher education. All around the country, we're seeing those trends. Now, tuition's still going up. So what we're seeing is young people are filling that gap, and they're filling it with loans. And those loans, both, you know, the public loans, the government loans, which have some really good consumer protections on them. If young people are having struggles paying them back, there's options for them. The really scary part is this private lending market where we have lenders, private banks, who are actually marketing loans to young people and to people who are returning to school as education loans. Those private loans, which, you know, there's about $150 billion in private loans in America right now. They're stepping in to fill that gap. And students are taking out those loans, and those, you can't discharge them in bankruptcy. You don't have repayment options. They have terrible interest rates. And so, you know, we're seeing young people just sign a bunch of papers when they sign up for school, not knowing that part of the loan package that they're getting is from a private lender, that they're not able, you know, they don't have any options after college is over to be able to repay those loans. Then even bigger issue is for the folks who actually can't finish their college degree or can't finish their certification program because their debt burdens are so high. We've actually talked with young people who had to drop out of school, get another job so that they could start paying back their loans because the interest rates are so much that their loans were compounding over time and they couldn't keep up with how fast their loan was growing. So it's a huge problem, and I think it's really, really important that we talk about it and that we have a conversation about this as a country. What is the value that we place on education, and what is it that we're going to do to make sure that education is affordable? Is it a value that we have that young people and folks who want to go back to school are able to do that? And if that's the case, how are we going to make it possible that it's affordable for everybody who wants to and is able to go and get a college degree?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But what I see is I see the right pitting generations against each other. And I've had these debates with people my age and older. I know I went to college, you know, 25 years ago, and I remember it being a certain way. But you start looking at the facts, the cost shifting that's gone on, like I pointed out, here in the Commonwealth, 2/3 of the tuition costs were picked up by the state. Now 3/4 are picked up by the students. So I don't know that the generations understand how bad it's gotten, but what they do is this generation is just whining, and they don't want to have to pay for it. I've heard all of those messages. You know, how do we fight back at that?
It's a really good question. I think that's absolutely what's happening. There's certainly a whole set of folks who went to school, you know, a couple decades ago, but it was much more affordable. Even when I went to college 10 years ago, it was, you know, I could get by with some loans and a part-time job. Now my younger siblings who are in school, it's a totally different ballgame. All going to public schools, public universities, the tuition has increased so much. And I think it's really important for young people to tell their story and for people who are in their 20s and 30s to talk about the fact that, you know, I'm in my 30s and I'm still paying back my loans, or I'm in my 40s and I'm still paying back my loans. People need to understand that this isn't just an issue for 18-year-olds. This is an issue for American families.
Yep.
We actually have seen that of the $1 trillion in student debt, there's about $36 billion of it that's actually held by people who are over the age of 65.
Wow.
So this isn't just an issue for 18 to 22-year-olds. This is an issue that our whole country is affected by, whether it's your families, your parents who are co-signing your loans, your grandparents who are co-signing your loans, or debt that's literally following you for decades throughout your life.
So
it's a huge issue, and I think people need to talk about it and share their stories.
Yeah, I'm with you. So how do you see – because Mitt Romney wants to undo what the president has done by taking in student loans and making it a government loan, which I'm all in favor of. Why should we have a middleman in the middle of it? But how would it affect the student loan industry if Romney were to give it back to the big bankers, the middlemen?
Yeah, I mean, the big banks have their goal is to make a profit, right? So their job is to lend out as much money as they can at the highest interest rates that they can so they make profits. Their interest is not necessarily educating Americans. And I think that what happened in the last few years with the federal government taking over so much of the direct loan program is that you actually have the government that's administering and running these loans. The private lenders are still trying to figure out a way into that market. But the thing is, when the government has the loans and the government is lending out money, the government can also put good consumer protections on those loans. So there's a program called income-based repayments where people can set their loan repayments amount based on how much money they make. I mean, those kind of options exist within the government loans that give people some choices and some ability to repay those loans. In the private sector, those things just don't exist.
Yeah.
And of course, it's $1 trillion. Loans that are out there right now, that's a lot of money that the banks want, and they want to be making money off of it. You know, Romney and Ryan have in their proposals and policies, their policy would actually cut $3.6 billion off the Pell Grant program. You said it's about 1 million people would lose their Pell Grants. And in Pennsylvania, the average student would actually see their Pell Grant decrease by over $800. So there's real effects on what young people and students would see if these policies come into play, both in lenders who are making the loans and also in the grant programs that exist for them.
Yeah, and more shifting of cost, more redistribution of wealth as they're defunding the Pell Grant program. Tuition is going up, and as the state is walking away from higher ed, the same thing. It's this vicious cycle where the students are ended up getting screwed. And I guess the last question I've got for you, you know, How would it help our economy if we make sure that, A, the loans are affordable, but there's some measure of debt forgiveness and some measure of, hey, this is what you can afford to pay, so maybe this is giving you the chance to take that lower wage job as a teacher or working in the community?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue, too, is that we see young people are now making career decisions based on what can help them repay their loans. So, you know, we want people who are in the sector who are working as teachers and firefighters and policemen, working in their communities, nonprofit organizations, but the debt burden leaving school is so high that we're seeing young people having to make decisions about their entire career just to be able to repay their loans. So again, I think this is about a value. Like, do we want people to have access to an education? Do we value these roles in our society? If we do, we've got to figure out a way to create a path for people to get there. I think that this is going to be a huge issue in the next 3 to 5 years. This tuition is skyrocketing, debt burdens are skyrocketing, and young people are being saddled with this lifelong debt. And we've got to figure out a way to stop having defensive battles from one program to the next program. And we have to start talking about what is real reform in our higher education system and how can we figure out how to make it more affordable? How do we do cost containment for college education? We got to start thinking about that, and we have to start talking about it, because it's not just an issue for young people. It's an issue for their families, an issue for our communities. People want to be able to buy houses.
Yep.
You're seeing young people aren't buying houses at the rate were in the past because their debt-to-income ratios are totally skewed and they can't actually afford to purchase a home. These are things that are affecting our economy. They're affecting families. And we've got to figure out a way to go on the offensive and start talking about the real issues here for people and make sure that there's a path for people to be able to get a higher education and get the jobs that they deserve and that our whole society needs.
Absolutely. Ann Johnson, I appreciate the time. Director of Campus Progress. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Ask Me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. If you own a small business like me, you don't have time to spend doing all the paperwork, bookkeeping, and tax reporting. If you're like me, you want to focus all of your energy and attention on growing your business and succeeding. The paperwork's got to get done. The taxes have to be paid. Bob Miller, CPA, can help. Bob Miller and his experienced staff can handle all of your business's record-keeping and tax preparation needs. Thanks to Bob Miller, CPA, and the year-round attention of his staff, I don't worry about surprises when the tax reports are due. Bob and his staff can help you, too. They can accurately and professionally manage your business's accounts or your personal finances to ensure that you have access to all of the tax savings opportunities available to you. Call Bob Miller's team today at 717-737-7617 or check him out on the web at www.bobmillercpa.com. That's bobmillercpa.com, and take the worry out of tax time.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Ladies, cram the name by raising hate.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, podcast right there at the website, or get Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So Ann Romney was on The View today. Yep, she's on The View, and she said, you know, this running for president thing, it's a hard thing to do, very hard thing. And, you know, because understand, you know, Mittens lost in the Republican primary in 2008. He lost his Senate bid. You know, at some point you go, you keep losing, you got to give it up. Well, according to her, this is absolutely the last time. If he loses again, no more. Done. The woman hath spoken. And anybody who knows anything, you know, knows women are really the ones who are in control. That's where the power lies, which is why I find it really interesting that you see the Republican Party today with this assault on women and their rights. You just, come on, hey, stupid, wake up. Interesting, also after the debate, one of Romney's kids, Tag, which I'm going, yeah, Tag, really? Okay, well, Tag was doing a radio interview, and the host asked him,
what is it like for you to hear the President of the United States call your dad a liar? How do
you
react to that?
Well, jump out of your seat and you want to rush down the debate stage and take a swing at him.
Yeah, take a swing at him. Yeah, go knock him out. Yeah, I'm going to go punch the President of the United States. Yeah. What I found interesting about that, nice tough talk, because you gotta love that. You do a little chest thumping, a little puff out your job, a tough guy. According to his brother Josh, who claims that he's someone who has been slugged by Tag, Josh said, Josh assured the president that the president has nothing to worry about. They're going, wow, that's a good shot there by the brother. And, you know, I kind of looked at it and go, well, you know, that's what I want to see. I want to see two rich guys going at it. Yeah, I'm going to go slug him. Okay, well, enough of that. Esquire magazine has a profile of Jeff Flake. He's running for Senate there in Arizona. And another one of those moments where, you know, typical conservative, someone who, according to his brother, Scott, as kids, because they had a huge family, you know, growing up on the ranch there in Arizona, huge family, no money. You know, they made enough money to get by. But according to Scott, or according to Esquire, Scott explained to them, it didn't feel like we were poor, Scott said. We were always qualified for free school lunch and those kind of things. He says, I guess it was just a function of having so many kids, you know, being responsible, having all those kids that you can't afford them. Well, what I find interesting, and the reason that I bring it up, and I generally don't talk about people who need help. I'm all in favor of, you know, you need to feed the kids, you need to feed the family. I'm all in favor of helping. That's in the wealthiest country in the world. That should be a minimum. But Jeff Flake, as a congressman, was one of only four members of Congress to vote against reauthorizing funding for child nutrition programs. One of only four. He has been time and time again against the school breakfast program, the child and adult care food program, anything that helps the less fortunate, he's against. And he refuses to express support for the goals and the ideals for the National School Lunch Program that he himself benefited from. So you look at this guy and you go, explain to me how it is that you were able to benefit from these and you didn't have a problem taking them, but now with some almost 50 million people living in food insecure households, meaning that they're hungry, and 20 million children who need to take advantage of free or reduced lunches in this country, you're going to turn your back on them? And this guy wants to be the senator? But I guess, you know, it is the Republican conservative way. It is what they do. And it's what we see time and time again, isn't it? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, third hour of the program. Of course, if you missed any portion of the first two, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you get it. Also, the podcast, Stitcher. Right back.
Oh, 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The day after the presidential debate, six former Sensata workers and their supporters were arrested as they occupied the lobby of the Bain Capital-owned company. Mitt Romney's Bain Capital is sending their jobs to China. The workers are calling on Romney to stop the outsourcing of their jobs by the company that made Romney wealthy. They have set up a tent city called Bainport in Freeport, Illinois, to protest the loss of their jobs to China, thanks to Romney's Bain Capital. The workers tried to deliver a petition to the plant manager. Tom Gallrap is one of the Sensata workers who will lose his job when Bain Capital ships his job to China the day after the election. Speaking in a video the workers produced, Gallrap urged voters not to vote for a Romney economy.
How anybody can go and vote for Mitt Romney is beyond me, because we have seen what this Romney economy looks like here.
Romney's binders full of women remark once again reveals a Romney disconnect and a problem with the truth. Jesse Russell reports.
Of everything Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney said on Tuesday, It was binders full of women that seems to be having the greatest impact, and not necessarily in a good way. Lilly Ledbetter, who gave her name to the equal pay legislation signed into law by President Barack Obama in 2009, said needing a binder full of women to find suitable women for administrative positions showed a disconnect.
That binder didn't help me at Goodyear, and it's not helping the women across this country, making 77 cents for every dollar a man gets. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but over the course of a woman's lifetime, for the same work as men, women make on average $431,000 less than men. $400,000 could buy a house, put two kids through college, and pay for seven more years of groceries.
The other problem Romney is facing is that he didn't actually request the binders full of women. The resumes of suggested women were offered to him by a group called Mass Gap, which had planned to provide the materials to whichever candidate won the gubernatorial election. Jesse Mermel is the former executive director of Mass Gap.
Mass Gap approached the campaigns of candidates Shannon O'Brien and Mitt Romney and asked them both to commit to three things. One, to make best efforts to ensure that the number of women in appointed state positions is proportionate to the population of women in Massachusetts. Two, to select a transition team whose composition is proportionate to the women in the Commonwealth. And three, to meet with MassGap representatives regularly during the appointments process. Both campaigns made a commitment to this process.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The goal really is to incentivize companies to come here in Pennsylvania, but not put it under pressure of the taxpayers. The companies have to make the investment. The companies have to hire somebody or they get nothing. Not one red cent gets laid out by the Commonwealth, as it has in past programs. We think this is innovative and different than what other states are doing.
You heard him. You heard the guy who sponsored House Bill 2626, Kerry Bettinghoff. It's innovative and it's different. Evidently, they've figured out a different way of giving away money. And yesterday, the General Assembly completed another taxpayer-funded giveaway under the guise of job creation. Like I said, 2626 is going to give away about $5 million. The question is it going to create jobs? I mean, he said, well, they're going to create jobs. And is it? And is there any reason to believe that more handouts, that more wealth being shifted from our kids' futures and from our roads and bridges to these big companies is doing us any good? That's why I've asked Greg LeRoy, the guy who's written the book, The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging and the Myth of Job Creation. He's also the executive director of Good Jobs First. Greg, thanks for taking time for me.
Great to be with you again, Rick. How are you today?
I'm good. You know, this could have been much worse. Originally, there was no cap. Now it's just $5 million. But are we going to get anything back for our $5 million?
Yeah, and I say the way the bill's structured, you'll never know. And that it's a black hole. It's a question mark about whether this is a complete windfall or something that actually caused something to happen that wouldn't happen otherwise. You'll never know.
And that's the thing that bothers me. With all of this economic development, we keep throwing all this money out, and they keep throwing out this rhetoric saying, well, you know, job creation, we need tax cuts.
Right. And that's the dogma that prevails out there, that taxes actually matter much in the way companies make up their minds. And the point that everybody has to remind themselves is that taxes can't, because state and local taxes are microscopic cost factors for companies, 1.2% of their cost structure typically, nothing compared to wages, occupancy, raw materials, energy, CEO compensation in some companies.
Right.
I mean, so you're talking about giving away some tiny fraction of 1.2% of a company's cost structure. You just can't change very much behavior at that level, and you shouldn't, and frankly, you got to be mindful of doing what you point out in your intro, that is, are you undermining spending for schools and skills and community colleges and roads and bridges and other infrastructure that we know really do matter and that matter to every company on an equal basis and that will be there tomorrow, even if Acme Widget runs away to China tomorrow?
Yeah,
all those things really matter.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point about how little the cost is. But here again, we're foregoing education. Here in this state, they've cut $1 billion each of the last 2 years. We're kicking the most vulnerable of the most vulnerable to the curb. 70,000 citizens of this Commonwealth kicked off the general assistance budget. You know, you go, I'm sorry, I don't see how $5 million windfall to these companies who are, I'm sorry, I don't know how that's going to help create any jobs or bring anyone here. I just see it as sweetener. Here's a little bit more money for you. Are we seeing anything like this in other states? I mean, Benninghoff said it's innovative and different. Well, what's innovative and different about giving them money? Here's a free check.
Well, actually, this particular program is designed in a way that we think is really outrageous, and we blew the whistle on it in a study that we issued last April called Paying Taxes to the Boss. Because when you boil it all down, that's what this program consists of. What the money, the source of money, the $5 million, and it could have been much more, as you said, before the amendments were made, the money comes from workers' paychecks, from state personal income taxes. So as this law plays out, certain workers' paychecks will show, you know, $50 a month or whatever going to Harrisburg for their state personal income taxes. But in reality, 95% of that money is not going to end up paying for state public services. It's going to go to their employer.
Yeah, and what bothers me, Greg, is as far as I'm reading this, and maybe you've got a better eye than I do, but I don't get to know how that money is being spent. I don't know what they do with that 95% of that personal income tax. Nobody knows.
That's correct. I mean, the only requirements are that the company create a certain number of jobs and then maintain them. And there's some extra sweeteners for paying certain wage levels. But I don't pay any attention to those safeguards. It's good that they put those safeguards on there, clawbacks and job quality standards, we call them. But the whole structure of this program stinks. And you know, it's one thing to reduce the company's income taxes, the company's property or sales taxes. Historically, we haven't given them other people's money.
Right.
This is other people's money. This is workers' money.
Well, I've been saying for the longest time, Greg, that, you know, the true conservative world where we end up down the road is where workers pay their bosses for the privilege of working for them. You know, I keep hearing the far right in this state saying, you know, if we just did away with that prevailing wage and we just did away with those building trades unions,
yeah,
we could save 30% on building contracts. And you go, wait a second, that math doesn't even come close to adding up unless your true goal is to have those building guys paying you to build the building.
Yeah, no, this is dark business, and the there's just no incentive logic here. That is, there's no way this is structured to, so that anybody could credibly argue they're causing something to happen that would not have happened otherwise. So, you know, we think there is a place for things that are true incentives. If you want to create a program that encourages ex-felons to get hired or retrained, if you're trying to help dislocated workers find a new job, if you're trying to help women returning to the workforce from the household, get new skills and get back into the workforce. Those are incentives. Those are things that need to happen and aren't happening enough, and those people need help in the workforce. And those are worthy uses of money. Giving money to companies to let them keep their employees' personal income taxes is a different kettle of fish.
And here's the thing. When you start talking about subsidies and you start talking about, you know, tax incentives, for me, that's on what the taxes that companies are paying to the state. And as you said, this is money that workers are paying to the companies. You know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, 71% of the companies here pay no corporate net income tax.
Yeah.
So as I'm reading this, they would be eligible to not only not pay taxes, but also get paid back on top of that.
Yeah.
To me, there's something seriously fundamentally wrong with that.
Yeah, we're talking about a transfer of wealth from employees to employers. It really boils down to that, if a company wasn't paying any income tax either.
Let me ask you this. You know, I watched the debate the other night, and I saw Mitt Romney, you know, throwing out his, you know, government doesn't create jobs, government doesn't create jobs, and he was quite adamant about that.
Yeah.
Yet I hear people like Kerry Benninghoff, and I hear a lot of the Republicans saying, well, you know how we create jobs is we keep giving money away. We keep giving our kids' future away. We keep giving investment in our future away, our roads and our bridges. Keep giving that away, and that's how you create jobs. Has 30 years shown us at some point, do we wake up and go, 30 years of doing this hasn't worked?
You would hope so. I mean, there's certainly lots of very nonpartisan sources, like in the case of infrastructure, this group, the American Society of Civil Engineers, that issues the report card on the condition of our physical infrastructure every 2 years. And the grade has been going down, right, for all various things they rate.
Yeah, last I saw D, as a nation, we're somewhere in the D
yeah,
area.
Yeah, and the cumulative deficit we owe ourselves to catch up to rebuild our infrastructure keeps growing as well because we're neglecting to maintain enough and reinvest enough every year. We would hope, at some point, things have got to give. People have got to figure it out. And
In your experience, you're the guy who wrote the book, The Great American Job Scam. I look at this. This is part of that scam.
Yep.
This is not only them dodging taxes. This is us saying, well, we love you so much, we're going to pay you to hopefully come here. And, oh, by the way, you don't have to pay corporate income tax either.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely part of that. And I mean, look, some states have constitutional structures that make it hard for them to do some of these stupid giveaways. Other states, and I wouldn't recommend this, obviously, like California with Prop 13, have severe budget constraints caused by taxpayer referenda
right.
that make them stingy just because they got no money left because they're so artificially constrained by ballot initiatives that have been passed in the past. There has to be a reasonable middle ground here in which we, of course we want government to be efficient. Of course we want government to not waste money. But people have to understand that things the government does that benefit everybody are critical to economic development, are critical to the economic future of the state. And at the top of the list, obviously, are skills and infrastructure. And by skills, I mean everything from pre-K to dislocated worker, GED, ESL,
adult retraining,
all that stuff, as well as infrastructure. And infrastructure is not just roads and bridges. It's ports and smart grid and lots of other things, too. If we undermine our ability to fund those necessities that benefit every employer on an equal basis and don't discriminate and don't run away to China, we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, but if you hear the arguments on the right, well, the free market will take care of all of that. The free market does all that stuff on its own, magically, with the invisible man and the invisible hand. Haven't you heard?
I haven't seen any free market repaving any streets lately. So.
But they built it. I mean, didn't you see the Republican convention? They built everything. They didn't need you. They didn't need the taxpayer investment in all of the things that you laid out. They didn't need it. And here's what bothers me with all of these handouts. And look, I'm not against incentivizing certain behaviors. In fact, I'm very, very fond of it. I like the idea of saying, you know what? We need alternative energy. We're going to help that industry grow
right.
because we need that in the future.
Me too.
But, I want to know, is it working? And yet I'm not finding any really good resources that are going to say, well, this is the plan that, like Benninghoff's bill, we're going to give employees wages. We're going to give that tax money to the employer. We don't get to know what they do with it. I don't see any database that says, well, this is what they did with the money. This is how it benefited us. In fact, I don't see a centralized database of any of the economic development, so I don't even know where it all goes.
Yeah, and that's the key problem here, Rick, in terms of having an honest debate about it. State economies depend on many things that have nothing to do with economic development incentives, right? If you were to read the beige book that comes out every quarter from the Federal Reserve Bank with the regional studies that talk about state and regional economies, they don't talk about tax breaks or new incentive programs. They talk about what's going on with the automotive industry or what's going on with the aerospace industry or what's going on with the software industry or what's going on with, whatever the big industry is in that part of the country. Those are the real drivers. And if you look at the states that have done best or worst in the last decade, it's tied to whether it's got a lot of oil and it's booming, like North Dakota
right.
or Texas or Wyoming. Or a state that was especially hard hit by the automotive crisis and got hurt a lot by Ohio and Michigan, or is booming because of aerospace exports like Washington State, right? And those that's not about tax breaks. So, but people love to cherry pick and point to specific companies and make bogus, correlations based on things that don't necessarily mean causation
right.
All the time. We've got a study coming out later this year. There'll be certainly to flag to you looking at that issue of bogus correlations by people claiming certain magical potions for for state policy.
Yeah, like giving 95% of the personal income tax back to employers and not having any way of knowing it. Let me ask you, in looking at this, because they keep saying, well, it's gonna create jobs and it's innovative and it's different. How many other states around the country have done this kind of innovative and different thing as Benninghoff has said?
Well, 16 states have programs on the books. We documented them last spring. They cost those 16 states a total of almost $700 million a year.
Wow.
New Jersey alone, it cost them $178 million last year. But here's the big problem. Many of these deals, including ones in New Jersey and Missouri and Kansas and the Kansas City, Missouri metropolitan area, are simply companies staying in the same labor market but moving across a river, moving across the state line, so that the jobs as their new address are, quote, new to New Jersey or new to Missouri or new to Kansas. And therefore, the company now gets to keep a bunch of the personal income taxes, even though the people holding those jobs probably didn't move. And many of them already lived in New Jersey or stayed in Missouri or were already in Kansas. So there's no net benefit to the regional job market or the labor market. It's just, but there is harm to one state treasury, which is no longer getting to keep the income tax that would normally have gone there. The company is keeping it.
Now, or both. I mean, is it the state that lost it and the state that's giving it away?
That's right. That's right. One state's losing and another state's forgoing, and nobody's getting a new job.
Yeah, and the thing is, as you point out, no new jobs. And I'm sorry, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic as we're going down as a nation down this rabbit hole. And who benefits? Not you, not me.
Yeah. 17 prominent business leaders who in the Kansas City metropolitan area, all of whom do business on both sides of the state line, issued a public letter last year to Governors Nixon and Brownback, basically screaming at them publicly, saying, quit it. Quit raiding each other. They said it very succinctly. They said the only winners are the footloose companies,
yep,
who are dodging their taxes in one state and getting it forgone in the other. And we, the other companies, are getting stuck with higher tax bills paying for their free riding.
Yeah, I seem to remember a study not too long ago, and maybe you would know it, but, you know, the companies that engage in that, where they're hopping from place to place looking for the highest subsidies, they're the ones that end up eventually out of the country because they're used to moving, and they're going to go wherever the cheapest this, that, or the other thing is, or wherever they can get the most to put in their pocket, not necessarily make the best product or create the best jobs, but to put the most coin in their pocket.
Yeah, call centers are famous for that because they can be ripped up and moved around very quickly. I mean, if you're looking for companies that are footloose and love to game things out and want to run away as soon as the property tax abatement you gave them runs out, that's a flaky company.
Yeah,
you can't build an economy on a company like that.
Last question I've got for you. No, it's only $5 million only. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people who were kicked off the general assistance budget, I'm sure the ADAPT folks who aren't getting Medicare, I'm sure the low-wage workers who got kicked off the adult basic health insurance, I'm sure they could all use a little help. That $5 million would have done that. Is this the end of it? I mean, is this just the beginning? Do you see this expanding, or is this just electioneering, an election year thing so they can go back to their districts and say, look, I passed a job-creating bill, even though they can't really point to any real success?
I think it depends upon what the early deals are and how the thing plays out. But obviously, the nose is under the tent now, let's put it that way. And if they decide they like it, if they're going to land a couple trophy deals and brag about it, it would certainly make it easier for the sponsors to go back next year and say, well, what about $25 million or $50 million? So,
or 1.7, like we gave away to the cracker plant,
yeah,
that they were going to build in that exact location,
yeah,
anyway. Sad, sad stuff. Greg Leroy, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Great to be here with you, Rick.
Author of the book, The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation. I'm telling you, this is right there with that myth, another scheme. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, I'm the talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
For your right.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Let us now assess the state of the free press in this land of, well, of press freedom. The assessment? Pathetic. Not because of some government clampdown, but because of increasing press pusillanimity. The latest decline in hard-nosed investigative reporting is something called, quote, approval. It began with PR flacks for public officials and political candidates, demanding that reporters agree as a price of being granted an interview to submit any quotes they intend to use from the interview to the interviewee's staff for approval. Thus, when Mr. Big blurts out something shocking, stupid, or actually newsworthy, Mr. Big's staff of bowdlerizers can tidy it up, or even erase it. Zzzt, it's gone, as though it was never uttered. It's not surprising that today's media-sensitive political figures, including Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, would demand this extraordinary editorial control over what comes out of their own mouths. But it's utterly despicable that media bosses and reporters have so gutlessly caved in to the demand. It reduces reporters from hard-nosed diggers to brown-nosed beggars, and it makes a mockery of our democracy's need for a free press. Yet many of America's major publications have meekly surrendered their reporters' freedom to this restraint. And now, corporate executives have realized that, hey, we can emasculate the press, too. Wall Street barons, Silicon Valley hotshots, and even the bosses of media conglomerates are demanding and getting, quote, approval for stories about their operations. This is Jim Hightower saying, the media columnist for the New York Times admits that he's also succumbed to these demands. If it's a quote I feel I absolutely need, he recently wrote, I start negotiating. Never mind that it's his independence and journalistic integrity he's bargaining away.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you
going up and down, yeah, there we go. Yeah, right there on that one. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Can't help it. Like the song. Big Elvis Costello fan. It is what it is. Interesting interview on Bloomberg TV yesterday. Guy who was the former CEO of Morgan Stanley, a guy named John Mack, was being interviewed there on Bloomberg TV. He's the guy who led Morgan Stanley through the financial crisis in 2008. So, you know, when it was bailed out by the federal government, remember that little thing? He said something interesting. He said, let's be totally honest. A lot of people who have done really well have not handled the wealth very well. He said, that gets to part of the issue with Wall Street. He said, I think it's really challenging. I think the kind of money that's made and the way it's flaunted, look, it's wrong. He said the money was really unbelievably generous, to say the right word. He said at the end of the day, the one area that has to be squeezed to give back to the shareholders is the compensation number. And you look at Wall Street here recently, just said, you know, Wages are going to be at a record high. Pay the bonuses, record high. And, you know, he's not the only one saying things have gotten out of hand. The current CEO of Morgan Stanley is saying things have gotten too high, gotten too out of hand. And somehow, and this is where I think this election, more than any issue, this Wall Street issue has to be addressed. You have got two candidates, and look, Obama has tried. I'll give him credit for at least trying. I think Dodd-Frank was weak. I don't think it's near enough. I say we should have reenacted Glass-Steagall immediately after the crash. You want the bailout money? Glass-Steagall comes with it. That didn't happen. It was a two-page bailout, said, you know, well, we're going to give whatever. Don't worry about it. Smart people will take care of it. Well, they robbed us blind. Romney wants no control. Let them go. They learned their lesson. They have. They got the slap on the wrist. And I look at what's going on at Wall Street, and you go, there's something seriously wrong. All this money into the hands of a few, all of a system that is basically just gambling now. And you look at these high-speed traders. You know, the last few years, you've seen this boom of supercomputers taking over. And it was basically the computers with the people with the fastest traders, the fastest computers, they made the most profit. Speed was all that matters. Problem is, at some point, this is either got to break down or it's going to destroy the system. Right now, you've got these traders who can make a trade in under 10 microseconds. It takes 350,000 microseconds to blink. Think about that. How fast these trades happen. And how fast you could, with a computer glitch, and we've seen it happen, you could see this thing just collapse. And I'm of the mindset that, you know what, we've got to get in front of this kind of stuff, and quickly, because we've given too much control to the upper crust. We've given too much control to the very wealthy. Things have gotten out of hand. We need to rein this system back in. So, look, I want people investing in companies. I want them investing. I don't want people gambling. We don't bail out gamblers. But it's what we're doing on Wall Street, and which is why I've always been a fan of something called the Tobin tax. It's basically just a quick transaction tax. You want to do a trade in 10 microseconds? We're gonna tax a couple pennies onto that trade, make it a little bit more expensive. This way we have a little bit of money for the next time you crash the economy. You know, think of it as you know like the mob used to do, a little vig, pay a little vig to the house. You got to play your game. A little bit to the house. Make sure the game goes right. And the reality is you look at all of these high speed trades, which purely speculation, purely on millifractions of a penny. But because it's such a large numbers, they're making big bank, driving the prices up. And this speculation, look, leads to bubbles. So as they pump this stuff up, eventually it collapses. And who gets stuck with it? Well, you and I do, because we don't have fast supercomputers. We're not the ones who are playing the millifraction of a penny. So they don't lose. We do. They take it from our pensions. They take it from our 401ks and our IRAs and all the things that we're told, you know, invest for the long term, because, you know, it's a long road. So for me, the transaction tax is just common sense. And I don't know that it would discourage short-term currency trades or short-term stock trades or any of this stuff. But at least it would raise some revenue in the event that they collapse the economy again. Think of it as a sales tax. Every time I go buy a pack of bubble gum or I go buy something at the store, I got to pay a sales tax. Should be doing the same thing to these supercomputers. And look, if you hold the stock for 5 years, no tax. That's investing. The gambling part, not such a big fan of. But I look at this and I go, you know, this is where we've gone. And we've been sold that, oh, well, you know, we have to worry about Wall Street because they sold us those wonderful 401ks, didn't they? And how have they worked for you? And I was just talking about this with my wife yesterday. We were going somewhere together and I said, you know, I still remember the day I started with the job I held before I started doing this. And, you know, I was there right about 18 years. And when I first day, they said, you know, with your pension plan, you're going to be a millionaire in 30 years. Because, you know, we're going to put in all of this money and the stock market's going to grow at this rate. And, you know, the actuaries have said in 30 years of work and you'll be 56 years old and you can retire and you'll have $1 million. And I remember saying, look, you know, they're not going to let some dumb truck driver have $1 million. It's not going to happen. The people on Wall Street will figure out how to get it. The people who play the game, the people who have rigged the game, they're going to figure out how to, and they did. I mean, the reality is I got probably about $175,000 in that fund after 18 years. Maybe, you know, maybe if I stayed the last 12, maybe it would have gone to $1 million. Who knows? I seriously doubt it. But I look at this and I go, you know, there needs to be some protections for, if we're going to be saddled with these crappy 401ks, there's got to be some protections for you and me. You know, you need to be bailing out the people at the bottom, make folks at the bottom whole. But that's not what we do in this country. No, no. We love our billionaire class, don't we? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to check in with Victoria Jones and find out what's going on around the country and the world. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
If you own a small business like me, you don't have time to spend doing all the paperwork, bookkeeping, and tax reporting. If you're like me, you want to focus all of your energy and attention on growing your business and succeeding. The paperwork's got to get done. The taxes have to be paid. Bob Miller, CPA, can help. Bob Miller and his experienced staff can handle all of your business's record keeping and tax preparation needs. Thanks to Bob Miller, CPA, and the year-round attention of his staff, I don't worry about surprises when the tax reports are due. Bob and his staff can help you, too. They can accurately and professionally manage your business's accounts or your personal finances to ensure that you have access to all of the tax savings opportunities available to you. Call Bob Miller's team today at 717-737-7617 or check him out on the web at www.bobmillercpa.com. That's bobmillercpa.com. And take the worry out of tax time.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
All because the gays are getting married. That is why people die. And children go unfed when I'm not alone. And I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going down a toilet bowl. It's good to know it's cause to give.
They ruin everything, don't you know? At least that's what I keep hearing. It's what my right-wing friends keep. They ruin the sanctity of people's marriages. Like my friend who I've talked about several times. You know, his girlfriend and child up in Massachusetts, his wife and kids back in Pennsylvania. But somehow, those people are ruining the sanctity of his marriage. Nuts. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the fallout from the big debate still going on. Ben Stein said that, you know, Obama told a whopping falsehood. You've got Tucker Carlson saying that Wilkes Booth moderated the debate. It's worse than the assassination of Lincoln. Wow. Fun. Let's find out more of the blowout. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So worse than the assassination. Candy Crowley, she was John Wilkes Booth in disguise.
Yeah. This is actually probably one of the most ridiculous things I've ever come across in my adult career as a member of the media, because it was not a terribly important part of the debate.
No. But here again, and people wonder why my biggest fear is that my daughters will come home with someone like Tucker Carlson. There's another example.
Yeah, well, or anybody in a bow tie, really.
That is a very good point. But, you know, I look at the fallout from the debate. You've got Ben Stein, who in his very boring way, you know, said, well, you know, Obama, he told a big fat lie, and Romney should have said, Your Honor, Your Majesty, you just told a big fat lie. Whopping falsehood over what happened in Libya. And the truth of the matter is Candy was right. She did correct him rightly. And I wish at some point, and I've talked about this with a couple people over the past couple of months, that, you know, maybe we need that on the spot fact checking to say, no, you're wrong.
And it's fascinating that she not only said that Obama was saying something that was factually correct, in the same statement, she also said that the administration had basically jumbled things up for several days. So she also gave a point to Romney at the same time. Why doesn't anybody talk about that?
Well, that wasn't good enough because she stabbed him in the back, and then she tried to cover up. See, that was just her trying to cover up. She's really an Obama operative. In fact, the one of the crazy groups who sent out a press release said she should have to register as a super PAC. I would assume that's a shot at her weight.
Oh, tell me you're making that up.
No, I think it was Citizens for or Americans for Limited Government or some right-wing group that sends me their press releases. He said that if they're going to continue to employ her, she should have to register as a super PAC. And at first I thought, well, maybe it was a shot at her weight. I don't know, you know, but just dumb. But my favorite one, Peter King, who really is off the deep end anyway. Peter King was on CNN, I think it was last night, where he really tore apart both Republican talking points. The one that Obama waited 14 days, of course, which is wrong, and the other one that the president didn't specifically describe the attacks in that statement on September 12th. He said, first, it took the administration almost 4 minutes into his statement on the 12th to mention that it was an act of terrorism. So it wasn't fast enough in his speech, according to Peter King.
Oh, so he concurs that he did do it on that day.
Yeah, I mean, he did it on the 12th. He did say it was an act of terrorism, but for Peter King, it just wasn't fast enough. It took him.
What about all the other stuff that he said about how terrible it was that they'd been killed?
Yeah, well, it wasn't fast enough, see? I'm just telling you what the man said.
I'm sorry. There's a certain point at which I feel like I'm going to have to hang up now. I'm going to have to put my head in boiling oil.
No, please don't do that. We like you too much for that. He said, quote, I'm going to use my words very carefully. He said, I think the president's conduct and his behavior on this issue has been shameful. And first of all, as far as it's been an act of terror, the president was almost 4 minutes into his statement on September 12th before he mentioned an act of terror. Yeah, that's his.
Yeah, because he was talking about what a tragedy it was, because he was focusing on the deaths of human beings.
Yeah, see, you're going to have to register as a super PAC, Victoria Jones.
I just can't handle it anymore.
It's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, it really genuinely is. It's nuts.
And you want to hear something even crazier? I just read a report here a couple minutes before we talked. In The Nation, Greg Palast did some investigative reporting, found that the bailout of General Motors actually netted Ann Romney and Mittens at least $15.3 million, perhaps as much as $10 million more.
How did they make that money?
Off of, you know, the stock that they had and all of the investments they had in the auto industry. through their blind trust, of course. You know, the blind trust that invests in his kid's business, the one he has no control over. It just happened. It was magic. It was such a great investment that everybody's got it.
Right. Obama's probably invested in his Mitt Romney's son's business through his own pension.
I'm sure everyone else is too. I'm sure mine is. I bet you I've got money in. And what do you think of a tag wanting to slug Obama?
I'd like to see him try.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see that, but I love the stab in the back by his brother. His brother Josh said, "Yeah, I've been slugged by Tag. Obama's got nothing to worry about."
Exactly. That's what I was. The first thing I thought was, I'd like to see him try. Obama's pretty darn fit.
Oh, like the one person said, it would be a slap. It'd be a couple. They'd slap him. Let's get to the news. Big news today: the Defense of Marriage Act struck down in the Second Circuit.
Yeah, this is the second time it's been struck down in a court of appeals. The first circuit struck it down in May. Yes, the Second Circuit said it unlawfully discriminates against same-sex married couples by denying them equal federal benefits.
Yeah, I mean, that's that whole Constitution thing that the right loves to talk about the Constitution, but that whole equal protection thing, that whole blind in the eyes of the law and all that, not such a big thing. And the part about this that caught my attention is the chief judge, this Dennis Jacobs, probably one of the more conservative justices in the court system today.
Yes, he's a conservative judge. I believe he's a George H.W. Bush appointee.
Yep.
And a previous judge who's written on this is a Reagan appointee. So, I mean, these are not loopy liberals who are writing about this.
So let me ask you, I mean, because I had someone throw the conspiracy at me. How much is this, the conservatives going, let's make this an issue so that we get our base all tingly in the panties and all wadded up?
I don't think it's an issue at all. Okay. I think it's just happening.
It's just the timing of the court.
I think it's just the timing of the court. I really do. I don't think that the courts are that organized.
Okay. Well, good. I'm happy to hear that at least. I saw some interesting polling numbers, and I listened to the Peter King statement, proving that Romney is dead wrong, the Candy Crowley thing, he's wrong. I mean, he thought he had the moment. I mean, Romney really thought he had the moment where he was going to jab Obama, and Obama's like, God, keep going, keep digging your hole. Here's the shovel. He's actually gaining in foreign policy. What the hell is that about?
Yeah, but there was a Reuters Ipsos poll done between the 4th and the 7th of October. So that's about 3 weeks after the attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, Libya, in which the U.S. ambassador was killed. And Obama leads 47% of voters on foreign policy and 43% for Romney, who could do a better job on that. So it's a substantial gain for Romney because he trailed Obama by 15 points. In September. It would be interesting to see the results after this second debate.
Yeah, my question is what will Romney's foreign policy be once Obama leaves office? Let's say just it happens somehow magically, Romney wins, he's the president, he's commander-in-chief. What's he going to do when he can't say or do the opposite of whatever it is Obama did?
Well, I believe he has 14 senior foreign policy advisors. 17 of them served in the Bush-Cheney administration. So I don't think you have to look very far to see what he would do.
Yeah. Or there's the other part of it where, I don't know if you remember him, a couple of months back saying he was going to do absolutely nothing for the first 100 days.
There you go.
Maybe that. Maybe nothing. Interesting. The fiscal cliff coming up, we're heading down that road to the next ticking bomb hostage situation, the next episode of 24. What's going on there?
Yes, the next episode of 24. Well, President Obama is apparently prepared to veto legislation to block year-end tax hikes and spending cuts. That's what the fiscal cliff is, actually. Unless Republicans bow to his demand to raise tax rates for the wealthy.
Yeah, and?
Well, Republicans aren't happy.
And So we're going to hold the country hostage. We're going to go over the fiscal cliff. We're going to collapse and all of the negative, our tax-mageddon and all of that because we refuse to raise the taxes of people who have done extraordinarily well, better than probably any time in history, at least any time in the last 70 years, at a time when we're running massive deficits, huge debt. Asking for people who have money to help, that's a bad thing?
I don't know exactly what's going to happen because it depends whether he wins or he loses, how strong his, you know, the Democratic positions are in the House and the Senate. It depends on so many things, but I think he'll feel either way, whether he wins or loses, that he has nothing to lose. It's being called the Thelma and Louise economic strategy.
There you go. You have Thelma and Louise economic strategy. Wow, that's a new one. Where'd that come from?
Wow. I may be coming from the Republicans.
I'm trying to remember the name of Thelma and who was the guy during the Clinton years where they torpedoed health care back then? I forget.
I don't remember who torpedoed it.
Well, I mean, there were a bunch of groups who ran these ads, you know, the couple sitting at the
table. It was Harry and Louise.
There you go, Harry and Louise. Thank you. See, I knew you. See, right there. When I need the hand, you're there with the assist.
I'm there. I remember Harry.
That's why you're the professional. That's why you're the journalist. You're the person we go to for the news. But yeah, so nice torpedo job. Also, a big night tonight. President Obama was on the Daily Show.
Yes, President Obama on the Daily Show. Quite serious interview. They did talk about Libya. He says we weren't confused. He said it several times, actually. He got into a bit of a mantra about it, about the things they weren't confused about, and he was really strong on his defense of Libya. He also said every piece of information that we get as we get it, we laid it out to the American people. The picture eventually gets fully filled in,
right?
He said. So you know, he was pretty fierce on the Daily Show as far as Libya. They did have some light moments, and Stewart pushed him pretty hard on some issues as well.
Like Candy Crowley did, because you know, six of those 11 questions were softballs to Obama. Were these softball questions from John Stewart?
No. Some of them were. He did ask him how often Vice President Joe Biden appears at meetings in a wet bathing suit.
And how often he smirks and giggles and laughs and smiles and throws up his hands.
I don't know whether he asked him that. I just know that he asked about the wet bathing suit.
Yeah, that's an image I wish you wouldn't have brought up.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. Yeah, I think Obama wished he hadn't brought that up, too. He had a good comeback, though.
What was it?
He said, we had to stop that. I got to say, though, he looks pretty good.
Yeah, there you go. I'm glad they put a stop to that. That's and nothing on the binders, though. They didn't bring up the binders. They didn't bring up. Did you see the?
I don't know if they brought up the binders of women. It wouldn't surprise me if they did. They haven't leaked everything that he said.
Did you see the Romney ad, the new abortion ad that Romney's running?
No.
Here, listen to this.
You know, those ads saying Mitt Romney would ban all abortions and contraception seemed a bit extreme. So I looked into it. Turns out, Romney doesn't oppose contraception at all. In fact, he thinks abortion should be an option in cases of rape, incest, or to save a mother's life. This issue is important to me, but I'm more concerned about the debt our children will be left with. I voted for President Obama last time. We just can't afford 4 more years.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Nah, I'm sure you do. You know where part of the commercial was filmed?
Go on.
In the kitchen.
Oh, my God.
And I wonder if while she's in the kitchen, if she's wearing shoes.
No, I'm sure she's not wearing shoes. Shoes get in the way when you're baking.
I just thought it was hysterical. And I love that term. You know, I care about abortion, but really I care about the debt. I'm going, I know there have got to be millions of women out there. That's what they're thinking. It's right there, right in the front of their mind. It's the debt and, of course, the timer because my muffins are coming out.
Oh.
I'm glad I got that reaction. Victoria, great talking with you.
Thank you. You made my night. Good night.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
Researchers suggest the bright lights of cities visible on Earth, even from space, have the potential to reveal the existence of alien life on other planets.
Someday we might want to look for city lights on distant worlds. That's according to Avi Loeb of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and Edwin Turner of Princeton University. The researchers point out that as our technology has moved from radio and TV broadcasts to cable and fiber optics, we've become less detectable to aliens. If the same is true of extraterrestrial civilizations, then artificial lights might be the best way to spot them from afar.
Loeb and Turner calculate that today's best telescopes ought to be able to see lights as bright as those of Earth's biggest city, Tokyo, in the outer part of our own solar system. In other words, if there were any cities on the edge of our solar system, we ought to be able to see them now.
It's doubtful there are cities on, say, Pluto, and all the stars, even the nearest ones, are no closer than 10,000 times Pluto's distance from the sun. So we don't yet have telescopes that could see city lights on planets surrounding these distant stars.
But future generations might spot them. To learn more, come to earthsky.org and search for alien cities. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Neither of these things absolves us from blame. So speaking for the senior management team and myself, while we can't assure you we won't make mistakes, We can assure you we're going to try not to. These were egregious mistakes. They were self-inflicted. We are accountable. And what happened violates our own standards and principles by how we want to operate the company. This is not how we want to run a business.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I still got Jeff Flake on my mind, the congressman from Arizona, who, you know, according to his brother, their large family, their large conservative family, benefited from all of the social programs that have been passed over the years, the school lunch program, things like that. And he's a guy who's against all that stuff. Climbed up the ladder, has done very well for himself and great for him, but on the way up, smashed the ladder behind him, or at least wants to. And it's one of those moments where you go, what made this country great is that every generation looked backwards and said, come on, we're going to pull you along with us, and we're all going to go forward together. And I look at someone like Flake, who quite possibly is going to probably be the senator from Arizona. What he's going to bring to the Senate is more of this, this head in the sand, more of this divisiveness. We used to believe as a society, all of us together, and you've got them who have really split us in half, and it's a shame, because I go back to my childhood and I remember quite often, especially during the summers. There was a program when I was a kid that you'd go to the local school, whether the Pyrtus Elementary School before they tore it down, and in the summertime, right around lunchtime between, 11:30 and 2, they would have lunch. And you'd get a little tin of something, beans and wieners, macaroni and cheese, something. And for the majority of the kids in that line, that was the only hot meal they got all day. But what it was, and it was only, understand, we didn't do it out of the goodness of our hearts. The reason that all happened was because the military demanded it. Because, during World War II, we had people who were malnourished. They couldn't pass the physical. They couldn't carry the gun. So as a society, we said, we should strengthen them up a little bit. And then feed them. And it became a social thing. And he said, the Christian nation thing, bought all that stuff. Yeah, okay. First thing Reagan did away with that. First thing the conservative movement did away with. So when I hear the right tell me, Rick, government shouldn't do those things. Let private charity do it. My first thought is, one, if private charity could do it, they would be doing it. If the churches could, they would be. If they could meet the demand when the demand is high. And if you remember after the 2008 collapse, the food banks were swamped. There was not enough to cover it. Private charity couldn't keep up. So, one, if they could do it, they would. And two, it becomes very fickle. And I remember, you know, just the other day we talked about Paul Ryan, who basically barged into the St. Vincent de Paul Society soup kitchen there in Mahoning County, Ohio. And he just burst in, you know, did his 15-minute pretending like I'm scrubbing pots and pans for the photo op, of course, and left. 15 minutes, about 15 minutes. He was there. That's it. You know, hurried up, got his apron on, did a little this, did a little that. Hey, take this picture. Make sure you get me scrubbing. Make it look like I'm working. And then bolted. Now, the guy who ran the place, this Brian Antel, he says, look, you know, we're nonpartisan in all of this. We don't want, if they'd asked, we would have said no. We don't want that. We want to be left alone because you know what? Our funding base is so fragile. If we pick one side or the other or someone gets a bug up there, you know where, our funding goes away and we could end up not serving the 100,000 people that we serve annually. He says, look, I'm a volunteer. I don't receive any money doing this. And when people withhold their donations, it's going to hurt those 100,000 that they serve annually. Well, what's going on, according to Antel, is since the Romney debacle, or the Ryan debacle, where he just barged in and, take a picture! Well, funding's drying up. And they won't say where the funding is coming from. I don't know if they know yet, or where it's not coming from. I would suspect that, you know, because they want to make it out to be, well, it's those evil liberals who are holding the money. I don't think so. I think it's the conservatives who are ticked off that Ryan was called out. That this guy would have the audacity to say, you know, we wouldn't have invited him. We didn't want him. Leave us alone. Let us do our work. I'm telling you, that's where my thought on this is. And it's going to be interesting over the next couple of days, the next couple of weeks, as the media picks up on this, you know, where this happened. Because, you know, conservatives, they like to hold their people accountable. Like Mitt Romney says, loves to fire people. So, that's where my thought is. I think that you're going to see that the conservatives who've pulled back this funding and who are sticking it to these people. Sad stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like the tide.